Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. Welcome to another edition of Blue Shirt Banner Radio. It is Tuesday, December 8th, and we are as fired up as we could possibly be tonight. Let me bring my co-host in right off the bat. Eddie, good evening. How are you, sir?
I am doing fantastic. I'm excited. We've got one of the all-time great Ranger legends. Basically, I'm telling you right now, he is the senior member of the Ranger Legends. Emil Francis is here. I'm excited.
I'll tell you what, if there is such a thing as Ranger royalty, Emil definitely sits at the head of the table, that is for sure. So without further ado, why don't we welcome Emil Francis to the program. Emil, good evening. Thank you for joining us. Jim and Eddie, how are you tonight?
Hi, Jim and Eddie. Thank you very much for having me on, and I'll tell you, there's not a city I like to go on radio or TV with more than New York, because in all my life, and I've been around a long time, New York is still my favorite place. I'll never forget New York. They were the best years of my life.
Well, that's good to hear, and we're glad you like being on TV in New York. And tonight you're going to have to settle for Dania Beach and Ronkonkoma, because that's where Eddie and I are set up. That's the power of the Internet. So we got a lot to talk about with you tonight, Emil, and we have a surprise for you a little later on in the show. So let's get to it. And you know, we were doing some research and getting ready for the show tonight. And what I didn't know is that you were the first goaltender to experiment with any kind of catching glove. Up until you tried. You used a first baseman's mitt, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
Well, you know, what they had, like, you know, they had what they called a five-fingered glove the goalkeepers used, and had a very small cage, like, you know. And if you look back at the goalkeepers before me, very few of them caught the puck clean. They would bat it down, like, you know. Well, all the years of my life when I played hockey, I made a living in the summer playing baseball, and I got paid to play baseball, and I started managing ball clubs when I was 24. So I looked at those gold gloves, and my hand would be hurting so much. Like, I says, there's got to be something better than this. So I took and I'm a Yankee fan besides, I took a George McQuinn, first baseman Smith. He was playing the New York Yankees. I got the trainer to take the cuff off a hockey glove and sew it on to the first baseman Smith. And I used it for about a year and a half, you know, and I had no trouble, but I'll tell you, when I got that puck was in that thing and it never came out. And that was my, you know, I wasn't the biggest guy in the world, but that was my strong forte, was my glove. Now we go to Detroit, and we're playing in Detroit. And in those days, teams would come on the ice at 8 o'clock, or pardon me, at quarter to 8. You'd warm up 15 minutes, and they'd blow the horn. The referees would come out at 8 o'clock, you'd start the game. They didn't resurface the ice. So here, Jack Adams is coaching Detroit. I'm playing for the Chicago Blackhawks. So King Clancy, and I'm sure you guys know who he was.
Oh, yeah.
He was refereeing, and Jack Adams, was a big, heavy set guy. We got excited. His face looked like Santa Claus, all red, like, you know. And they're pointing at me, like, you know. I'm under. I look behind me. I said, maybe there's no gold judge here, you know. Well, I look back there. There's a gold judge. So down comes King Clancy. He said, let me see that glove you got. So I show it to him. He looks at it. He looks at it. He says, you can't use that. And, you know, in 1950, 49, you only had one goalkeeper. That's only you only carried one goalkeeper. So he said, you can't use that. I said, well, I'll tell you, Mr. Clancy, if I can't use this glove, you have no game tonight. He said, what do you mean?
Oh.
I said, I don't have any other glove. And I'm not going to use any other glove. He said, where do you go from here? I said, Montreal. He said, I'm going to call Mr. Campbell. He's the president of the league. And you go see him with that glove of yours. And he can decide whether or not you can use it from here on in. So we get to Montreal. I had to go meet with the president. And he looked at my glove. And he was on the Nuremberg trials. He represented Canada. I thought I was in the Nuremberg trials. He had me there for an hour. Where'd you get this from? How much you pay for it? How come you have this glove? Where did it come from? I was there for an hour, all cross-examination, like, you know. Then he sat there for about 3-4 minutes. He said, okay, you can use it. Well, you know, I was so stupid what I didn't do, like, you know. I should have patented that glove.
Because oh, yeah.
The news leaked out, and within a month, you should have seen all the different companies, starting with CCM and with Rawlings. They all started making gold gloves, all copied from what I did.
Ah.
You were the pioneer. You could have made a fortune.
I know. Oh, I could have, but, you know, at that time in hell, all I was concerned about was making myself better. And I knew if I could get that first baseman, Smith, when that puck went in, that glove would never come out. Not like the old gold gloves they had.
Now, you played for the Blackhawks for a couple of years.
Yeah, 2.5 years I played with Chicago Blackhawks.
And were you were the starting goaltender there, correct?
Yeah, you only had one. I was the guy, yeah.
Right.
And the only reason I got a chance, I was 20 years old. Like, you know, Chicago were a bad team. They were in last place. And when a team's in last place, one or two guys are going to get fired. The coach will get fired or they get a new goalkeeper. And I was fortunate enough to get that chance to come in when I was 20 years old and play for Chicago.
Now, I want to – what was it like when you first got to Chicago? Now, I read this story – when you first came to the Rangers from Chicago.
Yep.
I read this
yep.
story, and I had a hard time believing it. So why don't you clear this up for us? I read – that you played because Chuck Rayner got hurt. You played a game and you shut out Chicago, and
3-0.
And you flipped Bill Tobin the finger.
He was the general manager of the Chicago Blackhawks, like, you know. And I'll tell you, I never seen a more mismanaged team in my life. And I learned a lot from that, like, you know, because he had the rights to the Chicago's farm club in Kansas City. And he owned the farm team. He was more interested in what the farm team was doing than what we were doing. We were playing nights with 13 and 14 players. And, I was smart enough to know. I mean, my dad had died when I was 6 years old, and I had to fight for everything I had all my life. And I was smart enough to know I'd been in the Army, and I was a sergeant, and I knew what discipline was about, and I knew what organization was about, like, you know. And when I got to Chicago, I said, this can't be a National League team. I couldn't believe what was going on there, like, you know. So anyway, I get traded to New York. And they sent me to New Haven because they had Chuck Rayner, and you only carry one goalkeeper. And about a month after being there, they fired the coach, Neil Colville, and they brought the guy, Lynn Patrick, you know, of the Patrick family, and the coach of Rangers. And the first game was in Chicago, and Lynn's first game as coach of the Rangers was in Chicago. And I'd played for him, like, you know, for a year and a half. So he called me up, and I went in there, and I shut the Blackhawks out 3-0 right in Chicago. And I knew where Tobin sat. It was right to my right. So I'd give him the finger, like, you know, well, he's supposed to be the league. And they hold me in, like, you know. I mean, I was making, I think, $6,000. They fined me $500, Grace, half my salary.
just
wow.
Think, if you'd have done that today, Emil, you would have been all over the Internet flipping the GM.
Oh, God, yeah. Oh, God. I mean, you know, today they get $75 meal money. I'd have played for their meal money today.
Now, all right. Now, one of the guys you played with on the Rangers was Freddie Shiro, right?
Oh God, yeah, yeah.
Now, you got any good stories about Freddie? I mean, you know.
Oh, I'll give you a real good one, like, you know.
Okay.
We're playing in Cleveland, and Cleveland was a fine club of the Rangers at this time. we had a real good team. We won 3 straight Calder Cups, like, you know. So anyway, it was during the early 50s, and TV was really coming to prominence. So we had to play. The American League scheduled games on the weekend, so we had to play Friday, Saturday, and Cleveland, we always played Sunday afternoon. So we played 3 games in less than 72 hours, and everything was done by bus, like, you know. Anyway, we played Friday, Saturday, we played Sunday afternoon in Cleveland. Now, here we are, we're playing, we're practicing on Monday morning. And Jackie Gordon, another ex-Ranger, Fred Shearer, I'm skating on there before practice, and another ex-Ranger, Bun Cook was a coach, who incidentally was a great coach. So, Freddie Shearer comes up to me, he says, "Hey, Cat," he said, "what are you doing after practice?" I said, "What do you mean what I'm doing after practice?" I said, "I'm going home," because I was married and, you know, I had a couple of kids. He said, "Well," he says, "I need a favor." I said, "Sure, what do you need?" "Well," he said, "I got out by myself last night." And he wasn't married, of course. "Somewhere or other," he says, "I lost my car." I said, "Really?" I said, "Well, are you drinking?" "Oh," he says, "I had a couple of drinks." I said, "Well, okay." I said, "I brought Jack Gordon with me." So I said, "The 3 of us will have to go in the car because I'll have to take him home." So right after practice, we get in the car, and you start thinking where the hell you were, and I'll drive you there. Well, we went to about 9 bars, like, you know, and hell, there was nothing. "Is this the place?" "No." "Is this the place?" "No." So finally, I turned. He was in the back seat, and Jack Gordon's in front. I said, "You know, Freddie, I'll tell you what we're going to have to do. I'm going to drive you to the police station, and you go in there, and you report your car stolen." I said, "Hell, there's 1,000 police in Cleveland. They'll find that car a lot quicker than we will." So I took him to the police station, and he went in there, and he reported his car was stolen. Guess what? They found it the same afternoon. That's Freddie Shearer.
So even in those days, he was Freddie the Fog, huh?
You got that right. But he was a good player.
When you played with him and you knew him back in those days, did you have any idea that he'd go on to be such a successful coach? Or did you just think, you know?
Well, you know, I hired him, like, you know, he coached in the International League in St. Paul. And I took over general manager of Rangers. And, I mean, he was a real thinker, like, and he could play. I mean, he played with the Rangers in 1950 when we went to the Stanley Cup Finals, like, you know, with Detroit. And we played the first 2 games at home. We weren't home for a month. All the rest of the games are on the road. And Freddie was a real good defenseman. The only problem was he couldn't see. And now we had another defenseman in Cleveland, and he couldn't see, a guy by the name of Tommy Williams. And Tommy Williams wore glasses. Freddie didn't wear glasses, but he should have, like, you know. So anyway, Jim Hendy, who's a New Yorker, and he started the hockey guide and all that. At the end of the year, he decided that both those guys would have to get contact lenses. Well, you know, teams didn't have a hell of a lot of money then, and he bought both those guys contact lenses. And the next year, he played with contact lenses. Fred Shearer made the first All-Star team and scored 25 goals. So they asked Freddie, he said, "What's the reason for your success?" He says, "Well, it's the first time I could see where the goal was." But he was a good player, you know. He was a good player. And a good guy, and tough as nails. He had been a boxer in the Navy, and his favorite hobby, when we were in New York, every Friday night he'd go to Gillette.
The prize fights?
Friday night, every Friday, right. Because, you know, we had prime seats there, like, you know. And he loved boxing, and he was a good boxer himself in the Navy. I mean, I'd never seen him fight, but I've seen him fight a couple times. The guy's challenged him. I'll tell you, he could handle his dukes. He was a tough guy. Sometimes forgot where he was going or where he was coming from, but it was all right.
The Rangers, you know, Emil, some of the Rangers have a few defensemen now that some nights we're wondering if they could see.
I know, God. I look at, you know, and that's the first line of defense. I mean, they got a great goalkeeper. And, you know, you build a hockey team, same as a baseball team, right down through the middle. You got to have a goalkeeper. You got to have 2-3 real good defensemen. You got to have 2-3 real good centers. And then you build from that, like, you know. And I'm a little concerned about the defense. I think they should be a little tougher there. They should move guys from the front of the net a little more. But they've changed the rules. If I said once, I said 1,000 times, let's see if that guy can score on his ass. In other words, knock him down. Nobody stands in front of that net. But now if you touch a guy, you're in the penalty box. I mean, I don't like what they've done to hockey. Oh, there's a lot of things I don't like about it. I don't like that shootout. I think it's a gimmick. I don't like overtime. And I don't like when you lose, you get a point. I mean, I'm all for you win, you win. If you lose, you get nothing. I can't believe
right.
the team loses and you get a point. And it changes the whole standings around. It's not fair. It's not right. You know?
Now,
crazy.
And the shootout has changed the mindset of a lot of teams. Sometimes they get into overtime and they just play for the shootout. They just try and survive those 5 minutes, get to the shootout, and take their chances there.
Yeah, and then when you get to the shootout, it's like, you know, this was about, 10, 12 years ago. And Canada was playing Sweden. And in Olympic hockey, of course, that's how they decide games, have a shootout. Now they're playing for the gold medal. And this guy Crawford, Bobby Crawford's coaching Canada. And they're in the shootout. And this is it. Gretzky's playing for Canada. And guess what? They had a five-man shootout. And he didn't, Gretzky set every record in the National League, the biggest goal scorer ever. He didn't list him as one of the five guys. And guess who won? Sweden won on the last shot. The fifth guy shooting for Sweden scored, and Canada lost. I mean, here's Gretzky. God almighty, the highest scorer we'd ever had in the league at that point in time. And the guy didn't even list him. And I see now they have shootouts. They put guys down there, defensemen have had one goal all year, and they put him in the shootout. And
yeah.
I'm saying, this is such a gimmick. Get out of here. Like, all you're doing is wasting time. Get it over with, you know.
And especially that they get rid of the shootout when playoffs come. So it's a total gimmick in the regular season, and it doesn't count in the postseason. So it makes no sense. There's too much gray area. It's got to be black or white, win or lose. That's the way I look
at it. Exactly. I mean, suppose you had a baseball game. You end up at the end of nine innings and say, okay, we're going to have a home running contest. And they put a guy out there to throw the ball up and see who can hit the ball out of the park. It's stupid, like, you know. I've never seen anything like this in my life. I mean, I hate it. I hate it because it's changed our game. That's not the way hockey's played. You win or you lose.
And now you were at the Ranger game the night before Thanksgiving a couple weeks ago. I was at that game too.
I was there.
Where they went? Did you stay for the shootout?
Sure I did. Well, you know, because I want to see the Rangers. Like next year, I'm pulling for the Rangers to win. Like, you know, but as I was watching, I mean, I don't like it. And, you know, I hate it. I really do. I think it's a gimmick, and I don't like gimmicks.
Yeah,
not when you're playing for real.
I don't like it either, but it makes, man, I'll tell you, I'm on my feet watching the damn thing and nervous as hell if the Rangers are in one.
I know, I was with the Rangers, and Bill James was the person of the Rangers, so first time I ever heard this, it was him. And, of course, he's the guy that came up with expansion, like, I'll never forget him. We were at the Old Garden practicing up on the fifth floor, and he said, I'd like to have lunch with you after, like, you know. And so I went in the restaurant with him. He took out a napkin, paper napkin. He said, okay, he said, you've been around hockey a long time. He said, we've only been in the business 2 years. We bought the Garden, we bought the Rangers. And next he said, here's this napkin. Write down there six cities in this country who you think should be in the National League. I said, what's that? You know, I thought the guy lost his marbles. He said, hockey's too good of a game. And there shouldn't only be six cities in the world that can see the National Hockey League. Write down six cities that you think we should consider bringing in to the National League. So I wrote down Philadelphia and Pittsburgh and Buffalo because I'd played in all those places in the minor leagues, like, you know. But I said to him, I said, you think that there's any possibility that this is going to happen? He said, I think, he says, that our game is too good of a game for only six cities to have the opportunity to see National League hockey. And if we don't expand, there will be another league. Then he says, we're going to have a problem. Well, we expanded, but still the other league came, the WHA. It still came. But he was right. He was right. Like, you know, I mean, hockey was such a great game. And he spotted that as a business person, that we can't control six cities and keep the National League right within our grasp, like, you know. And then, of course, the World Hockey came along, and, you know, we had the reserve clause in the contract like baseball had, and they sued us for $100 million. They said they couldn't compete, like, you know, because we had the players all locked up. So the judge ruled, like, you know, that we had to get rid of the reserve clause and people could be free agents after whatever contract they signed, 1-2 years, and had the opportunity of being free agents. And then there's wide open season. And here we are.
I want to just get back to you were playing in the WHL and you retired, And then Muzz Patrick kind of brokered a deal that brought you back to the Rangers organization to work in the as coach and be in the front office. Is that correct?
Right. Yep, that's correct.
Now, how did that all come down?
Well, it's a funny thing, you know. 2 years before I retired, like, you know, I was in the summer, I'd go back to Western Canada, and I was a playing manager, and I ran baseball clubs for 10 years, and I won 7 championships. And I made a connection when I was in New York with Buzz Bavese, who was running the Brooklyn Dodgers. And Buzz told me, he said, "Geez, I understand you play baseball, you run ball clubs." I said, "Yes, I do." He said, "Where do you get your players from?" I said, "Since Jackie Robinson came in, I got 4 or 5 players from the Kansas City Monarchs because they folded up, like, you know." And I said, "I have 8 or 9 black players playing for me that I've got from that league." Well, he said, "I'll tell you what," he said, "we have 500 players in Vero Beach. Why don't you come down there?" He says, "and whatever you need, if you need 5, 10, 15 players, you get them from us." I said, "Well, I don't need that many. Each year I'll need 3 or 4. He said, "Well, you come to Vero Beach," which I did. And it's funny, you brought up Fred Shearer's name. I took Freddie with me the first time I went down there. And
but you drove, right, I hope?
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Oh, God, yeah. We never got there. So, you know, I'll never forget, they would train in Vero Beach at that time. They didn't play exhibition games there. They played the exhibition games in Miami. So now, like, you know, the first time I ran into that, we drive in there, Freddie, and Freddie was always like the tail on a cow, laughs, like, you know. And we get to drive in, and I'm trying to prod him. I want to get there. I want to see batting practice. I couldn't get him to move, like, you know, so... Anyway, we get there, and I can hear the national anthem playing. So, "Freddie, let's go, let's go." And I'm running, like, you know. So I go run in, and the big guy there with his cowboy hat on and his gun, like, and he says, "Hey, can't you read?" I looked at him and says, "What do you mean, can I read? Because, you know, I'm a little feisty, too." He says, "Take a look there." Well, the ballpark was cut in half. On the left side was whites only, and on the right side, blacks only. And I was running into the black section. And I didn't even know, like, you know. That's the first time I'd ever seen anything like that in my life. Like, you know, I mean, here I had always, all the years I ran ball clubs, I had 7, 8 black players the whole 10 years, and they were good ball players out there. Well, we won 7 championships. Well, because of that, when it came time when I was going to retire, there was only 6 teams in the league, and there were 3 teams offering me jobs. They must have thought because I had Puerto Ricans, blacks, Canadians, Americans, whites, you name them, I had them, like, you know. If he can handle those guys, he can handle anybody. And Tiny Thompson, who was a great goalkeeper of the Boston Bruins, Hall of Famer, and he was the chief scout of Chicago Blackhawks, and I'd come up through their system in Moose Jaw, which is a sponsor club. And he helped me as a goalkeeper, you know. He always said, "When you retire, you're coming back with the Chicago Blackhawks. We want you to take over our sponsor club in Moose Jaw." So anyway, I said, "Okay, I'll do that." And they kept, you know, Tommy Ivins running Chicago. I got to know him later on. I knew why it took him so long because he was so deliberate. He was always trying to get the best deal, you know. And even though I retired, Spokane owned my rights, and they wouldn't get a release until they got what they wanted. They wanted somebody to replace me. And Tommy was negotiating for about 2 months. Meantime, like, you know, I'm sitting there, and Tiny Thompson said, "We got 4 or 5 players. We want to get into the Blackhawk organization, and if you go, they'll come with us right away." So I went out and I was recruiting for him, and I signed these guys to go to Moose Jaw. Then finally he called, he said, "They want a press conference in Moose Jaw in 2 days' time to announce you're coming in as a general manager and coach." "Okay." He says, "When you get there, they'll negotiate your contract with you." I said, "Fine." So I started out to drive to Moose Jaw, and I had driven, it was about a 350-mile trip. I had driven 200 miles, like, you know. And I stopped the car, and I got up, and I walked up and down the road for an hour. I said, "This isn't right. What the hell am I doing here? I'm running around getting players to go to Moose Jaw. I don't even know what they're going to offer me. They haven't even got my release yet. I'm walking into a, you know, Hell's Acre here." I said, "Nah." I jumped back in the car, turned around, and go back. My wife says, "What are you doing home?" I went right to the phone. I called Tiny Thompson. I said, "Tiny, this is not right. Something tells me I'm out of here." I said, "Get somebody else. I'm not going. If I have to go back play another year, I'll go back play another year." He said, "Well," he said, "I'm sorry to hear that." I said, "Tiny, this is not right. And it's not your fault. It's that guy in Chicago. Because he's done nothing in 2 months now." Well, when all this was going on, Muzz Patrick called me from New York. and offered me a job becoming the Ranger organization. I told him, I said, as much as I can, because I made a commitment to go to Chicago. Okay, he says, no problem. Well, about 2 days after this happened, I called Tiny Thompson. Chicago announced that they'd signed me to Prestigo to Moose Jaw. So who do you think calls me? It was Muzz. He said, what's going on out there? He said, you told me you're going to Moose Jaw. I said, Muzz, I'll tell you what happened. Well, he said, if I can make a deal with Spokane, will you come with us? I said, sure. Well, he said, you can have a job with our top minor league team. Or he said, we just bought a junior team in Guelph. And he said, you could go there. What do you want to do? I said, Muzz, I played pro 15 years. And if I'm going to go to an organization, I want to start at the bottom. I'd like to go to Guelph. He says, you got it. I'll get back to you. 2 hours later, he called back. He says, the deal's done. That's how I ended back up with the Rangers. I went to Guelph for 2 years.
And you had Gilbert and Rattell at Guelph,
yeah, exactly.
Right?
Like, yeah. Oh, God. Yeah. The first practice, like, you know, I'll never forget, I had with that team. And I'm watching, like, you know, and I said, holy Christ, these two guys are better than anybody I played with the last 10 years. Like, the Rangers have two real good I could tell right off the first practice that these were going to be two special players. Oh, you could tell. I mean, that's how good they were, like, you know.
Emil, do you remember how much they paid you in Guelph?
Yeah, $5,000
yep. a year?
Yeah. But you know what? At that point in time, when you broke in the National League, that's exactly what you got. And the average salary in the National League then, in 1960, the average salary in the league was like $12,000 in the National League.
Right.
Oh yeah, you know, things are so different, like, you know. And
oh,
you know,
yeah.
that was the start of a good coaching career in hockey for me, because we had a real good team, and we ended up. We ended up in first place, and we beat out Niagara Falls, which is a Boston Bruins sponsor club. And we had to play Connor St. Mike's, who was a Toronto Maple Leafs sponsor club. And they had a luncheon for us in Guelph, because I think we lost 2 games all year. We had this luncheon, and at the end of the luncheon, a guy came up to me and says, hey, Emil, he says, I'm really worried. He says, what are you worried about? Well, so you got a good team. I know you end up in first place. He says, but he says, you know, you're playing St. Michael's College Majors, and St. Michael's in Canada in hockey was like Notre Dame was in those years in football. He said, they're all Catholic boys. He says, you know, he says, they all go to church and they all light candles when they're going to play that night. I said, don't worry about it. I got a key to the same church, and when they're lighting those candles, I'll be right in behind them blowing them out. But I put him at ease.
Now, besides Rattell and Gilbert, who were some of the other guys you had in Guelph that maybe Ranger fans in general don't know about
Mike McMahon went on to play for many years, like in the National Hockey League, played for Buffalo. A kid by the name of Ted Taylor, who was a centerman, he went on and played for several years, like with Minnesota North Stars. And a guy who was a real tough kid, Bobby Plager, he played for him. He was only 17 years at the time. He went on and played in the National League for 16 years with the St. Louis Blues. In fact, he still works with them, like, you know. He's still scouting for him. And, yeah, we had some real, real good prospects that I inherited. Like, you know, I was lucky. I fell into a nice little team, believe me. Roger Burns and John Rattell. A guy by the name of Van Prudhomme was a scout for the New York Rangers. And, you know, you couldn't go within 50 miles of Montreal. You couldn't go within 50 miles of Trump because that was territorial rights. And this guy, Ivan Prudhomme, went into Montreal, and Montreal has so many players, they didn't even know those two guys were there. He's the guy that found them. He's the guy that got them to Guelph. And when he got them to Guelph, you put them on a sponsor list. The minute they're on your sponsor list, they belong to the New York Rangers. So a guy by the name of Ivan Prudhomme is the guy that found them.
Wow. Now, how dominant were they in that league? Who was the better player? I'm pretty much guessing that Gilbert was the pure goal scorer and Rattell was more the setup man, but who was more dominant at that age?
Rod Gilbert was leading the league in scoring, and John Rattell was second, about 5 points behind him. And Rod Gilbert got hurt with about 4 games to go in the league. And John Rattell, you know, he was such a shy guy and the finest hockey player that ever played for him. He didn't want to go past him, but he didn't. and he ended up winning the scoring championship. Like, you know, John Rattel would have made a 20-goal score out of me. That's how good he was. He was a great playmaker, really a good playmaker. But there were like twins, like, you know.
And you realize, I mean, it sounds like they were opposite personality-wise, you know, later in life. Rod was kind of a man about...
Oh, God. Well, John Rattel wouldn't look at her, he wouldn't look at a girl sideways. Rod looked everybody straight on. I had to watch him like a hawk.
they were
great guys. And I mean, they played for me for 16 years. Rod thought he was the Joe Namath of hockey, I think.
Yeah,
well,
I know Rod
at the time, right?
Yeah.
At least in New York he was.
Oh, yeah. And he's still there, like, you know. He's a real New Yorker. He came to New York to play, never left. Really a good player. Exciting player. Every day, same as Rattel. They were two of the most... It was a privilege for me to coach those guys all those years, believe me. You could depend on them. They were good players. They were the key to your team.
Now, okay, so... You were in Guelph for 2 years, and then you moved on to the Rangers.
Yeah, for 2 years as assistant general manager.
Okay. Give us a little background on how you came to get offered the GM job with the Rangers.
Well, they invited me to come into the National League draft meetings in Montreal. That's my second year in Guelph. And they brought me in. They said, we want you to come to New York, and we have to build up a farm system and a scouting system. And that's what we want you to come in here to do. So for the next 2 years, I wore out about 3 suitcases. I mean, there wasn't a hockey player put on a pair of skates that I didn't know. I went everywhere, watched hockey at every level, starting with junior, junior A, minor leagues. I knew after 2 years, I knew every player. I had a book on every one of them. And then the third year, I guess in about November, they fired Muspatrick, and I was on the ice. In fact, running a practice for a month. And he came up to me, he said, at the old garden, you know, on the fifth floor, he said, they just fired me. I said, what? He said, they just fired me. I said, I'm out of here. He said, listen, you little B, I brought you here to eventually take this team over. He said, you're not going anywhere. I said, no, I'm out of here. I said, you're not going to be here. I don't want to be here. He said, you just sit back and keep quiet, and I'm going to tell you what you're going to do. And, you know, Moses, Christ, he could have picked me up in one hand. So anyway, they called me in that night and offered me the job as a general manager of the New York Rangers. I said, well, I'll consider taking over this team under 2 conditions. One, I said, I've got to have absolute say in what I'm going to do here. And two, I said, I was here in 1950 when the Rangers went to the Stanley Cup Finals. We had 2 games at home. We'd never seen New York again for a month. It's not fair to the players. It's not fair to the fans that we have to get out of the garden because the circus is coming in, and I don't want to take over a team and build a team, which I will. I know I can. And build a team to get in the playoffs, and we got to go play in Toronto and Montreal and play our home games on the road. I don't want anything to do with that. So they said, well, we'll see what we can do, and we'll get back with you tomorrow. Well, he called a guy that owned the circus who would come in there, like, you know. And evidently, he said that he wouldn't give up his dates, but he said he wanted the 3 performances every day. But to get 3 performances in, it meant that we couldn't play until 9 o'clock at night. So James came back, and he said, well, what do you think about that? I said, hey, 9 o'clock at night, 10 o'clock at night, it's home. I'll go for that. But we want to play in our own building. And that's what we did. And that's how the Rangers got to play at home from then on. And we made the playoffs 10 straight years.
Yeah, I remember those late games when the circus was in town. I remember when I was a kid, my dad took me on a Sunday night to a late game. It was supposed to be at 8:30, I think, start after the circus. And I was maybe 10 or 11 years old, and the Zamboni broke at the Garden. And in those days, they only had 1. And the game didn't wind up starting until like almost 10 o'clock. And oh, my God, my mother was so mad at my father because we didn't roll in until about 1:30. All right, Emil, in honor of you being with us tonight, we wanted to make this really special for you. So we have a little surprise for you. Eddie, why don't you go ahead and introduce our surprise for Emil.
Well, you know, Emil, we love you. We want to, you know, we wanted you to bring together you and one of your ex-players, one of the backstops of the New York Rangers. Gilles Vellemure is on the line, and he wants to say hello, and he wants to, and here he is, Gilles and Emil, go at it. Do what you guys do best. Talk about the old days.
Hi, Emil. Hi, Emil.
Hey, Gilles, how you doing, my friend? I'll tell you,
I'm doing
Gilles
great.
And Eddie Jockman, we won the Vezina Trophy. We had 15 shutouts between Eddie and Gilles. I never seen goalkeeping like that before in my life, and the Rangers have never had goalkeeping since that. I'll tell you that. I mean, God, 15 shutouts. You think they'll get 15 shutouts again? Not in the way they're playing hockey today, I'll tell you, but it's because we had Gilles and Eddie Jockman. And, of course, Gilles caught with his right hand.
Go ahead, Gilles.
You know, Emil, do you know why we did that? Because we had a good system. We had the greatest system there was, you know. That's why we did so good in goal.
Well,
because the forwards were coming back, and everybody was coming back and helping us.
Now Gilles, I know... Go ahead, Emil.
You know, Gilles, hockey games are lost in your own end. You have to have a system to come out of that end. There shouldn't be any more than two passes. And hockey games are one of the other guys in. And you know what our system was. I mean, we used to forecheck. Send two guys in, but we always had that third guy high, like, you know, so that there was always one forward coming back with two defensemen. There's always three guys plus a goalkeeper that had to beat. They can beat four guys, and they're entitled to score. But we never got caught.
Exactly
never
right.
Got caught with
no, never
three
did.
Forward because that's the way we played.
Yeah, we did very well for checking, you know, and like a Gene Mattel. And coming back, we had the defense to do it. You know, we played very well.
Yeah. And we always had a good power play.
Let me ask you.
We always had a good power play.
Great.
Go ahead.
We had a great power play.
Emil, when you had to pick between Eddie Jockman and Gilles Vellemure, and you being an ex-goaltender yourself, what was the thinking process of who you're going to start? You got two great goaltenders. How would you make that decision?
All you could do, like you know, is go on the matter of fact of what each one did against certain teams. And Joel could play against teams that didn't play good that Eddie didn't play that well, and vice versa. Like you know, so you looked at their record and what each one did against certain teams, and then you played them against those teams, like you know.
And now, what was it that made them different? What was it that made them better suited to play different teams? Was it anything in particular, or was it just kind of a hunch or type thing?
No, they were two different type of goalkeepers. Gilles was like myself. You know, he's small and he was a stand up goalkeeper. He played his ankles. He didn't try to beat you. You had to beat him. And Eddie would make sometimes. You know, an easy save looked tough because he was sort of spectacular, like, you know. And when you do that, sometimes you leave yourself open, like, you know, shots between your legs or to be pulled out of position. You can never pull Gilles Vellemure out of position because he wouldn't move. He'd just stand there and he'd dare you to try to shoot at him, like, you know. And so, like I said, you had to beat Gilles. And Eddie was an aggressive type of goalkeeper. He'd try to beat you. And when you're an aggressive type of goalkeeper, often you leave yourself open, like, you know, to shots between your legs and shots on the short side. And Eddie would wander, he'd go behind the net, he'd go off in the corners, like, you know. And Gilles played strictly within that crease. They were two different styles, type of goalkeepers.
Now Gilles,
Gilles talk. Go ahead, Gilles.
I'm sorry, I want to ask
you a question. You did a great job choosing whoever was playing that night because we won much more than we lost. And Eddie and I got along very well, as you know.
And that's
I think for 3 years we had the best record ever for a Ranger team for wins and losses.
Okay.
And we played both ways. We played offensively and defensively.
I
wanted to ask Gilles just one question. Gilles, when you first meet Emil Francis, when you walk into that locker room, Do you remember the first couple times you met Emil, and what was your impression of him when you met him, and then as you started playing for him regularly, what did you think of him?
Well, you know what? I met him first was in Buffalo when I was playing for Buffalo in American Hockey League. He came in the dressing room and met everybody, shook everybody's hands. I said, this is a great, great guy, because you don't see coach, NHL coaches go to the minor team and shake the guy's hands, you know, in the dressing room. And I had a good impression right there. Very good.
And then how about as you played with him and you got to know him? Now, I know, Shields, I don't want to tell any tales out of school, but, you know, you used to like to drive the harness horses. And did Emil know about this, why the career was going on?
Oh, sure.
No, I didn't tell him. He caught me, though. He went to North Bay Swim one day, and I was driving the horse.
There's a story behind that. There's a story behind that. You know, Joe was driving at Roosevelt. I mean, for you to drive a Roosevelt, you got to be the top of your game, you know? So I go there, my next-door neighbor, he liked to go to the horses, he and his wife. So he invited my wife and I to go to the Roosevelt racetrack with him, like, you know? So I go over there. I've never been to a racetrack in my life before, like, you know? So I'm sitting there, and who comes over my table? Alan Cohen. He's the head guy at Madison Square Garden. So he said to me, did you come out to watch Jill race today? I said, what? What's he doing here? He says, he's running in the third or fourth race, whatever it was. Like, you know? I said, you got to be kidding. He said, no. So anyway, he runs in the fourth, and he wins. So Alan Cohen came back. He came back after. He said, well, did you make any money? Did you bet on Joe? Hell no. I said, I wouldn't bet on my mother in a racetrack. No way. But he won. I couldn't believe it.
Yeah, I know.
I couldn't believe
he
won.
But I kept in shape, you know. In the summer, I kept in shape for the summertime.
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah.
It kept my reflexes very high. It helped me a lot.
you could drive, I'll tell you. That would surprise me. That's how I found out that you were driving at Roosevelt. The chairman of the board of Madison Square Garden told me that you were there. I didn't know. Then I was so stupid I didn't even bet on you.
Now, Emil, after that, did you go to Jill's and say, what the hell were you doing on a horse? Or did you keep it, or did you just pretend like you didn't know?
No, because he knew what the hell he was doing. Like, it was not like Brad Park. We were practicing on Long Beach, you know. And this day was a windy day, and Frank Pace was our trainer. He and I have to practice. I always take the train in New York. So I go to walk out the door, and the door flew open, and here's a big motorcycle. And I look at it. I said, what the hell is this? Because there's only one guy left in the dressing room. Everybody had gone home. It was Brad Park. So I turn right around. I walk back in. I looked at Park. I said, let me ask you something. There's a motorcycle out there. That doesn't happen to be yours, does it? He said, yeah. I said, what do you do with that motorcycle? He said, well, I relax by riding up and down on the ocean front. I said, really? Well, while you're riding up and down that ocean front, I'm not relaxing. He said, don't let me get your ass on a motorcycle again. I'll find you $1,000. Yeah, that's the way he relaxed. You think I was going to relax? God. Lots of fun. Yeah.
I mean, you should have said to him, why don't you try racing horses like Jill's does?
No, but Jill was safer on that cart of his, and he was in that motorcycle, I'll tell you.
Yeah, you're right. It's safer.
Now, Gilles, while you were there, who were the defensemen that you played with, and primarily the main defensive core that was in front of you? And maybe I can get both your takes on each of the defensemen. What you had, Jimmy the Chief Nielsen, I remember him.
We had great defensemen. See, defensive defensemen and offensive defensemen. Brad Park was our main guy in the power play, and it was the guy who was, stayed in with Rod and things like that in the offensive zone. And we had guys like Dale Roth, Jimmy Nielsen, Rod Sealing, guys like Arnie Brown, guys like that, that were staying back for the two-on-ones. And I think we had the best team in the league for two-on-ones. I had no problem with that. better. Jimmy Nielsen was so good.
Yeah, now, Jim Nielsen always played with Rod Sealing, like you know, and Brad Park played with Dale Roth. And then, Jill, we had Harris, Ron Harris. And I'll tell you, Harris hit you, you stayed hit, like, you know. we had some good defensemen, like, you know. And then on the power play, like Jill said, we had Brad Park. And then I made a deal, and we brought a guy in who was pretty good in the power play, too, Bobby Russo.
Yep,
they were very good on the points, those two guys, like, you know, both of them.
I want to know, who were the real characters in these days? Shield seems like he's kind of a quiet guy. Maybe I'm wrong. I don't know. But who were the real characters?
Yes, I was compared to Peter Simkowski, guys like that. Yes, I was. Peter was a joker in the dressing room.
he's got that right. Simkowski was a character in the first degree. Like, you know, we went on a road trip in January. We always would go on a six-game road trip. And we lost our last home game, we had to go on a six-game road trip. So we started out in L.A. We got off the plane, and I called a meeting right away that night, 9 o'clock. So I said, you know, we're on a six-game road trip, and we're fighting for first place here. And we're going to have to come out here with at least 4 wins, if not more. And if we don't, I'm going to shake things up around here. Well, everybody left the room, and we had to leave for the bus the next morning. So I'm in bed at 6 o'clock, and all of a sudden my bed starts moving. Like, and I said, what the hell is this? And I thought it was one of those machines by the bed. But I look up and the chandelier is moving. I said, uh-oh, this is worse than this. I got out of that bed, I'll tell you, and I got the hell out of the room. I went downstairs into the restaurant. And one by one, all the players start coming in. And the last guy to come in, Stemkos, says, hey, Cat, you threatened us last night that you're going to shake things up. Christ almighty, you didn't have to call for the earthquake. That was him, like, you know. Then we go to Oakland, and now I arrange for the ice time, 3 o'clock, or pardon me, 4 o'clock to 5:30. And you know, you got an hour and a half, and that's how you arrange your practices. You know how much time you got. All of a sudden, at 5 o'clock, the lights go out, and here comes this guy walking behind one of our nets, and he's got his lunch pail there. And I said, "Yell at him," says, "Hey, are you in charge here?" He says, "Yeah." I said, "Put the lights back on," as we got this till 5:30. "You may have it to 5:30, but he says, you got it without lights." So I said, "You wait till you come to New York. You wait till this opens." And I'm yelling at him like it. He just kept walking like nothing happened. So, okay. I wanted to end up like, you know. So I lined the guys up along the boards, back and forth, back and forth. So finally, after about 10 of them, Simcoe yells out. He said, "Hey, the Cat's the only one that can see in the dark. Let's call this thing off." You know, I mean, he was just a character. Remember,
Jim? He was. Santa was the greatest. He was a great.
We're playing Chicago Blackhawks. Yeah. We're playing Chicago Blackhawks, and they got us down 3-2 in the series, and we're tied 2-2. We go into 3 overtimes. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. Now, I mean, you run out of things to say, like, you know. So I go in there and I said, "Hey, well, somebody put the puck in the net, and let's get the hell out of here." And Peter Simkowski says, "Yeah, yeah, put it in the net. It'll be too late to get a beer." Guess who scored the winning goal? Dropped the puck and ran down. He scored. You remember that, Jill? He scored the winning goal.
Yes, I do. The third overtime.
Yeah, third overtime. I mean, pressure meant nothing to
him. He was
him.
Funny.
I mean, you know, he was just, yeah, he was a real good player. I mean, that 71, 72, they were the greatest bunch of players I've ever been associated with because there was no jealousy.
You're 100% right.
They all played for one another. Yeah. They played for one another, like, you know. Best bunch of guys I've ever seen.
We all get along well.
Can you guys talk about a little about the Ranger, the Big Bad Bruin rivalry you guys had? You know, I mean, you had some classic games back then. I mean, these are like legendary rivalries. Yeah. Do you have any particular memories, Emil, about the series and, I mean, those years of games?
Sure. Oh, I can tell you one. They beat us out in 71, and, you know, we lost John Rattel. That's when he passed the puck to Dale Roth. He went to the front of the net, and Dale Roth broke his ankle, you know. Shot and hit Rattel in the ankle, broke his ankle. Oh, shit, I mean, he was our, you know, key player in our team. And they beat us out in 6 games, like, you know. Well, the next year we meet Boston again. And in those days, we'd finish on Sunday, and the first playoff game would be Thursday. So right after the game, we flew to a little town outside of Boston. Geez, I even forget the name of it now. I'll think of it. And we went there, and we practiced twice a day, morning and afternoon. And then we'd look at film, and then we'd all eat together. We did that Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. We even on Thursday had our pregame skate there, and now we have to go into Boston. Here's something you laugh at. Jill will remember this. I said, no. I kept thinking, I got to do something incentive. Like, you know, so I said, okay, in order for us to beat the Bruins, we're going to have 40 hits. I mean, when they have the puck, the only way to get the puck, you take the man out, and the second guy gets the puck. And it's funny how I figured out, because I'd kept all these stats for years. If you had 40 hits, normally you'd end up between 35 and 40 shots, like, you know. Giveaways, we can't have any more than 16 giveaways. We don't want to give the puck away in our end. We don't want to give the puck away in their end. And face-offs, we have to win at least 65% of all the face-offs. I had my assistant, Dennis Ball. And Dennis had a little hard time seeing, like, you know. But anyway, he kept all the stats for me, and I had all these sheets made up. And he came down. We go to Boston the first game. And first 5 minutes of play, Teddy Irvine gets in a fight with Bobby Orr. And, Christ, we scored three goals. They're off for 5 minutes. We have down 3-0. Well, we won that game. Okay, the next game in Boston again. Harry hit Esposito. They carted him out on the stretcher, and we never seen him again. That he was gone. He hit him, and his knee had to be operated on. He was gone. Like, I'm talking about Harris, like Ron Harris. So we get on the bus, like him. And Semkos is in the back of the bus. He says, every hit you got $5. So the first game we played in Boston, we had 80 hits. And they come up, and they're looking at the sheet, and they say, hey, you blind bum, yelling at my assistant general manager, man. You can't see. You grab you down for 5 hits. I had 7 hits. I'll say, for $5 a hit, like, you know. So we get on that bus after the game. Stemkowski yelled. He says, hey, Cat, what about that hit that Harris put on Esposito? How much is that worth? I said, I think we'll give him $100 for that one.
Yeah.
We wiped them out. Remember, Joe? We wiped them out in 5 games until we won all 3 games in Boston.
Yeah.
Well, we were ready for them that year.
We played very well in 72 of the finals. We got beaten in six game at home.
That's true.
But we played very well.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, you
guys. Well, the Peters word. We're down 3-1. Jill went in and beat him in Boston. We come back to New York. Scores nothing. The faceoff to the left of our net. Esposito pulls a puck back to Orr. And Bruce McGregor went out and poke checked him. If he had got that puck, he was gone, like, you know. But Orr, as good as was, he pulled it in towards him and stepped around him and fired. And that was the game. But if McGregor had ever put that puck away, it would have been our game, like, you know. Sure.
Exactly right. If we would have scored a first goal, it would have been tough.
Right.
That was a good
We were very tough when we scored the first goal. Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. We ever got ahead of a team, forget it.
Chills.
Go ahead.
I was just going to ask you, as a goaltender, I mean, obviously they had Esposito and Orr, but who are some underrated shooters on the Bruins that you had to worry about when you guys played them?
You know, Johnny Busick always gave me a hard time. He was great. Kenny Hodge, you know, and but Busick, I had a hard time with him. He was a great hockey player.
Johnny the Chief Busick, right? That was his nickname? I'm pretty sure. Yeah. That was such a great rivalry. And a lot of people say, and it's funny that Emil brings up the hits, because people have this thing that, especially after the Rolf incident against the Flyers, that the Rangers got pushed around. But if you watch the video, and I have a lot of the video, you guys didn't get pushed around. There were certain instances.
God, we didn't get.
Exactly. Emil, can you speak to that?
Sure, we didn't get pushed around by Boston or Philadelphia, any one of them, I'll tell you. In fact, on Thursday night in New York, we knocked the crap out of them to force a seventh game in Philadelphia. And we had a guy by the name of Jerry Butler. He was a tough kid, I'll tell you. He fought those guys. Ron, I mean, we had guys that could take on anybody, like, you know.
Jerry Butler beat up Ted Harris badly.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
man.
See, the thing was, and I knew what was going to happen. I knew what they were going to do. They're going to send that Schultz, that goon out there, like, you know. And I was going to start my five best players out there. That's who was going to start. And Vic Hadfield hadn't played all through the playoffs. He had broke his thumb the last game of the year. And we're going back there for the seventh game. I knew. And I'd called, talked to him on, he'd been practicing for a week, 10 days. And I talked to him on Friday. I talked to him Saturday, and we were playing Sunday afternoon. I wanted to make sure. I said, you know, Vic, here's what they're going to do. They're going to send the goons out there. I don't know who they're going to go after. They're going to go after somebody. And I'm going to start, like McGregor playing the left wing all along with Rattel and Gilbert when he, all through the playoffs. And I started Rolf and Brad Park. I was going to start our best players, like, you know. So anyway, I'm ready. He shoot the puck in the right side, right-hand corner, and Park went back to get the puck and shelf flush right over to the front of the net. Rolf had been playing really well, like, you know. Really, I mean, he could skate. He had nobody to touch him. He was the best skater on that ice, I'll tell you. And they went right after him, like, you know. That's what happened. And then the next shift, Jerry Butler's on the ice. He's across from our bench, and he collapses. He couldn't get back to the bench because from all the fights he'd been in Thursday night, he had ruptured his spleen, and he damn near died. We got back to New York. I had to take him, rush him to the hospital, put him in there, and he was operated on 1 o'clock in the morning. So we lost Hatfield. He wasn't going back out there. We lost Butler. And Dale Rolf, like, you know, I mean, he'd taken some severe blows, like, you know. But that's not the way the game ended. We were one goal down, and I had it all set up. I had Bobby Russo at the far end of the bench, pulled the goalkeeper going down their end, and a guy by the name of John DiBico, and you remember, he was the referee, he blew the whistle. Well, you know, I could see him to this day. He was within 10 feet of our bench. He blew the whistle, and he gave us a penalty for too many men on the ice, which was crap. We didn't have too many. I mean, normally they just blow the whistle in their face to puck off the center ice, and that guy called a penalty against us for too many men on the ice. We hadn't had a penalty all year for too many men on the ice, you know. The guy, you see what happened? The officials would choke when they went to Philadelphia. Before the game, I'm standing up there. We're waiting for the game to start. I hear this roar go up in the I said, what the hell is that? So I run down and I look, like, you know. And McCreary, who's from Windsor, Ontario, was refereeing the game. And there's a big sign on the scoreboard says, welcome, Bill McCreary. He says, the Flyers have won 26 straight games with you refereeing here at the whatever the hell they call the rink at that time. Can you believe that? Talk about intimidating an official.
Wow.
Yeah, really.
We won 26 games with you refereeing.
That's the spectrum.
We have won 26 games with you refereeing, like, you know, beautiful. But
wow.
I said before, and I say it again, you're a bunch of goons running around in Halloween uniforms. That's what I think of Philadelphia.
You know what, Emil? We all played them badly the last game we played against them. I think we lost 4-3. We got 40-some shots that game, and
yeah, the goalkeeper
was, you know, was unbelievable.
Yep. Perrant, wonderful.
Bernie Perrant, you thought was the difference?
And they've never had a...
Go ahead, Emil.
They've never had a goalkeeper since.
You're right. And maybe a little bit of Ron Hextall, but Bernie Perrant was an all-time great who got his
absolutely.
I mean, he got the eye injury on Don Maloney's errant stick, and that ended his career. But Shields will tell you, Bernie Prom was awesome.
Goalkeeper.
Well, he beat us.
He had a good goalkeeper.
He beat us in the last game.
When the WHA came, the Rangers didn't seem to lose much from the WHA. Why was that? Did you guys pay him the big bucks over there, Emil? How come Gilles didn't come?
You asked me, I'll tell you what happened.
All right, you tell me.
Emil took care of us. That's why we stayed there. Believe me.
Yeah.
I went in Oakland one day, in the middle of the season. Emil sat me down. He says, I want to give you so much. Oh, my gosh. I almost jumped off his chair. He took care of everybody. That's why we stayed with him.
Ah, there you go.
Yeah. He's got that right. You know, the first guy he signed when the WHA started was, we went to Montreal, and John Martel went to go home in the summer, so I called John Martel in like, you know, I made him an offer, and he said, oh, he says, I don't know. He said, I think with the World Hockey coming on, he says, I'd like to sit back and just see what's going on. So I'll tell you what. You sign this contract now. Here's what I'm going to give you. And when it's all over, I said, what I do, John, I put every name down, and I put beside their names, I put who's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and then I put down what I paid them. Then if I'd been fair, the best player should get the most, and the second best player the second most, and third. And then if that all works out the way I've signed it, then I've done my job. If I've overpaid one guy or two or three guys that I've got them rated lower than what they should be, I said, I haven't done my job. So I said, I'll tell you this. As far as I'm concerned right now, you're the best player in this team, and that's the way you're going to be paid. So don't worry about what's going to happen. Sign the contract, and we'll go from there. And when it's all over, and we're ready to start, and I'll look at my list, and I'll see who's got what, and you should be the highest-paid player in this team. So I go all through all the negotiate and training camp, won't have it. Sure as hell, I got done. I put everybody's name in there, and I put everything there. And John Martel was not number one. I called him in. I said, here's your new contract. Then I give him a new contract because your word's your bond.
Right.
Wow.
Simple
as
that.
I just want to break in here for a second. And for those of you that might have just joined us, you're listening to Blue Shirt Bandit Radio. We have former Ranger player, coach, and GM Emil Francis, and former Ranger goaltender and Co-Vezina Trophy winner Gilles Vellemure on the line with us. And if you guys don't mind, we have a couple of phone callers that would like to say hello to you guys. They've been on hold for a long time, and they're old time Ranger fans, and I think they'd like to say hello. And let's bring on James first. James has literally been on hold since we went on the air at 8 o'clock. James,
oh,
welcome.
God.
Hey, how you doing, guys?
Okay. Reed, you're a real fan to be on there all that time.
Well, Mr. Francis, I'm a fan of yours. I mean, I remember as a kid, Ranger fan, and just listening to you guys, just a comment. You guys are great. Love listening to the stories. I can listen till Christmas.
Great.
Thank you very much.
Well, I want to tell you something. The best year of my life was all the years I spent in New York, and I was fortunate enough to have a lot of great players. And I'm very proud of the fact that I won more games as coach of the New York Rangers than anybody in history. And I think that may be one record that nobody will beat because nobody lasts here that long.
That's right. If you think you can take over now, I think we need somebody to run this team now, someone who knows what they're doing. I'd love to have you in there.
Yeah. Well, hopefully they'll get their act together.
I hope so. But I love the stories. A friend of mine, Jay Moran, who wrote a book, and you had some comments in there, and I loved all the stories. I'm loving listening to it now, and I loved one of them where he had mentioned, well, you had talked to him and said about how when the teams took the trains, the teams were not allowed to talk to each other. One team would be in the back of the train, the other team would be in the front.
That's right. Oh,
the dining car would be in the middle. You just couldn't eat at the same times. You know,
nope,
I love.
You couldn't. If they caught you talking to another, they'd fine you $100. You know, we were making $6,000-$7,000 then. You could, like, we'd be in the train station. We played in Montreal, and after the game, we went to Westmount Station, and we'd go sit in one corner, and the Canadians go in the other corner because now we had to get a train to go back to Chicago because on weekends you always played home and home, like, you know. So the home team would always go to the diner first. So the home team would be in the diner from 9 to 10. The visiting team coming back to Chicago, which is Montreal, would be 10:30, 11:30. And then the home team would eat at 3 to 4, and then the team coming to Chicago would eat 4:30 to 5:30, like, you know. They wouldn't let you come close to one another, like, you know. It was all for a reason.
No fraternizing.
You know, they wanted you to hate one another.
Man, that must have been something back then. Like I said, the stories are great, and you guys were tough back then, tough as nails, much more so, I think, than today's game and these guys.
Well, hockey's a great game, and I'd never say anything bad about the game, but I'll tell you, I liked the way they competed then a little more than they could compete now.
Right.
Emil, is that something that's missing from today's game, that hatred that teams had for each other and players?
Yeah, well, you know where that came about, I think, is when they started the Players Association. I mean, shit, you wouldn't recognize another guy from another team ever, like, you know. But I think that same as unions, like, you know, you get together and, I mean, the Players Association started. Not that they shouldn't have a Players Association, because I'll tell you what happened when I first broke in with Chicago. They needed a Players Association because there's only six teams, and they controlled it. I mean, either you did what they would tell you to do or you were done, like, you know. So they brought me in January, Chicago Blackhawks, and at the end of the season, season's all over, and they give us our, they were out of the playoffs, they give us our final check. So Monday morning, I go down to the Blackhawk office, and Bill Tolan was the general manager, and he was playing gin rummy with the PR director. So I walked in, he looks at me, he says, what are you doing here? What am I doing here? Yeah, he says, you got your check in yesterday. I says, I did. Well, he says, what are you doing here? I said, I come down to get my transportation home. Transportation home, he said, we brought you here. You take yourself home. I said, well, I don't think that's fair. I said, no, I live further away than anybody else on this team. They're all from Eastern Canada. I'm from way out in Western Canada. You know what he said? We didn't tell you where to live. I looked at him. I said, you little a-hole. I said, boy, this is a beautiful organization, like, you know. But that was it. So they needed the Players Association, believe me. But then, you know, they can go too far. Everything you can go too far with, like, you know.
Right. Well, I thank you guys. I mean, it's a pleasure being able to speak to both of you guys. It's great. And I know there's other guys waiting to speak to you. So thank you again, and I appreciate speaking to you.
Okay.
Thanks, James.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot, guys. Thank you very much.
All right. That was James. And let's bring in Ricky. Ricky, good evening. Welcome to the program. How are you?
Hi, guys. How are you?
Doing good.
Good. Good.
Hey, Cat. How you doing?
Good. Jilly, I'm doing very good, Rick. And I like your name. I have a son with the same name as you.
I got to make you guys laugh. I'm 39 years old, and my uncle Ray Rogers, I'm sure you guys don't remember him, but he was big into the horses and used to do some business with you, Jilly. And actually, going back to when I was 4 years old, he brought me home an autographed New York Ranger puck from you, and I still have that puck in my bedroom.
Oh, that's something.
And, you know, it just means a lot to me because my uncle's passed, and you were my first ever Ranger autograph. And I just want to tell you both, and I mean this from the bottom of my heart, not as a fan but as a person, I feel like I grew up like you guys were part of my family. I love you both, and I wish you both lived to be 150 and, you know, everything goes well for you for all the great memories that you guys gave me.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. Thank you
very
much. Very
nice of you. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Thank you. Chad, I got to ask you a question. Oh, go ahead, Mouth. I'm sorry.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, you know, speaking from us all, and, you know, we all do this, you know, we're not getting paid any money to do this. We do this for the love of Ranger hockey. And you guys, to me, Ricky summed it up well. You know, I mean, God bless you guys. We're chock full of memories, you guys. You were part of our lives, and it's glad to see that you're still part of our lives joining us here tonight. That's all I wanted to say. Ricky, go ahead.
Okay. You know, I know Jaber and Rattel get a lot of the, you know, a lot of the press from the 70s Rangers, and God bless them. They're both, you know, great hockey players. But my favorite player ever growing up was Walter Kachuk.
Good.
My all-time hero.
Great player.
I was just wondering if you could tell some Kachuk stories for me real quick.
I'll tell you one about him. Like, you know, he played for us about 8 years. He came up with our junior team, like, you know, in Kitchener. So anyway, now he comes to the Rangers, and it's about 3 or 4 years, and we had a press conference every Monday. And I always pick out one guy from the week before what they had done and bring with me, like, you know. So I bring him in there and I said, you know, Walter Kachuk had a big week. He got this, he did this, he did that. And Walter comes, stands beside me, he said, Mr. Francis, you don't pronounce my name Kachuk. I said, really? How do you pronounce your name? He said, Kachuk. I said, let me tell you something. You've been with me now 10 years, starting in Kitchener and with the Rangers, and you're telling me now I pronounce your name wrong? I said, you should have told me that when I first met you 10 years ago. As far as I'm concerned, your name is Kachuk, and it'll be Kachuk from the day you die. To the day I die. Walter Kachuk, that's your name. God.
I once met Walter, and I asked him a question. You know, I said, Walt, I says, you know, you guys got the Flyers going into the Spectrum, and You know, what's that like? Are you nervous? And he goes, kid, when I was young, I carried dynamite into a mine. That made me nervous. Playing hockey's great.
I guess so.
God, that's a good one.
I got to tell you guys something with Jill. Like, you know, I got a picture. I was going through something the other day. I got a great picture of Jill Villemure and Morris, the Rocket Richard, at a press conference.
Wow. Yeah, and you
remember
that.
That's
right, you know. Yeah. I remember
Have
that.
Have you got that picture? Have you got
oh,
that
I
picture?
I have it too, yeah. Yes, I
good,
do.
Good for you, yeah.
I remember that.
That's
that was
a great
picture. Yes.
That Morris, the Rocket Richard, and I'll tell you something. From the blue line in, he was the most exciting player I ever played against. His eyes used to light up like Christmas trees.
Yeah.
You're right.
You could smell the net.
I mean,
that's a great
yeah,
picture of Rocket Richard, you and I, Joe.
Oh, yeah, it was great.
Now,
as a matter of fact, I saw it about a couple of weeks ago, yeah.
Where was that picture taken, and where was it at? Was it on the arena? Where was it, in the dressing room?
No, it was at an Italian restaurant about three blocks from Madison Square Garden, Mama Leone's. That's where
wow.
we used to have their press conferences, Mama Leone's. Remember that name?
Nobody remembers everything.
That place.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
He remembers everything. You ask him, unbelievable.
Wow, he remembers whether the restaurant. What'd you have to eat, Emil? Do you remember that night or what?
He probably does.
I never ate big lunch. I had a bowl of soup. I never had big lunches. A bowl of soup was all I ever had.
Hey, now, Emil. Go ahead.
I want to ask Jill's a question. We were talking about Eddie Jockerman before, and the difference
yes.
in styles between the two of you. Did you ever watch Eddie play and move the way he used to flop around and move around his zone and skate all over the place and just say to him, "What the hell are you doing? Are you crazy doing all that?" I just wonder if you guys if you ever asked him, you know, how can you play like that or.
No, we know. You know, Eddie Jockerman was so good, you know, what he was doing, the way he was playing. It's just like a Tony Esposito flopping all over the place, you know what I mean? They know how to do it. They know when to go down on the ice, when to stay up. You have a good timing to flop around, you know what I mean? I couldn't do that. I was too small for that. I had to stand up, cover the angles, and that way cover most of the net.
And how about
the great?
How about you, Abel? You know, did you ever get on Eddie's case for the way he used to roam around?
Oh,
the
no.
There?
In fact, I used to work with him in practices and that for him to handle the puck and move the puck out, like, you know, because he could handle the puck very good, like, you know. And I think that his ambition always was to score a goal. And he could handle the puck and he could shoot it very good, like, you know. We were playing in Toronto one night and we were ahead 2-1. They pulled a goalkeeper and he shot from the point. He grabbed it, he put it down, he shot the puck. I said to myself, this is before any goalkeeper ever scored a goal. He hit the goalpost.
Oh.
He hit the goalpost.
Yes,
he'd have been, he'd have been the first guy to ever score a goal. But going back to what Jill tells you, like, you know, when I started, nobody ever told me how to play goal. I mean, you had to learn, like, you know, from trial and error. And I was in the National League. Nobody still hadn't told me what to do right or do wrong. And that's why goalkeepers – on the other team would become friends because that's the only association you had. You had to go maybe to him to get help, and this is going on in the National League. If they caught you, they'd fine you. So we're playing against the Boston Bruins. And Frankie Brimsek was the goalkeeper for Boston Bruins. He was a little bigger than me, but not much, like, you know. So we're passing one another at the end of the first period. As I'm going by him, I said, "Can I see you after the game?" He says, "Meet me in the there's a bar down below the old Boston Garden." So I go in there, and he was already there. He waves to me. We go in the back booth like that. He said, "What can I do for you?" I said, "You know, I'm getting beat on the left, my glove side, which I shouldn't get beat on. I don't know why I'm getting beat." He said, "Let me ask you a question." He said, "Do you play baseball?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "What position do you play?" I said, "I'm a shortstop." He said, "Well," he says, "I'll tell you something. You're playing goal like you would play at shortstop." I said, "What do you mean by that?" He said, "You're charging the puck like you would charge a baseball at shortstop." I said, "Yeah." He said, "Don't come out so quick. Slow yourself down coming up. You're coming out too quick, and then you have to back up. And that's why you're getting beat on your glove side. Because instead of your glove being in front of your glove's behind you." So next day we practiced, and sure as all hell, there was the answer right there. he knew right away being a goalkeeper, like, you know. So then he said to me, he said, you know, I'm a little bigger than you, but not much. He said, what lie stick do you use? I said, 11. So he says, I use 13. He said, you should try to take advantage of your size that you've got and stand up straighter, like, you know. So he said, use a lie 13. Try that. He said, I'll lift you up higher and you'll cover more of the net. I said, thank you very much. But that's what you used to have to do in those days. Your best friend was a goalkeeper in the other team. And the players knew that, and they used to kid about it. They used to say, the goalkeeper's union. Because they knew the goalkeeper talked about it.
Well,
that's
Gilles,
the help you could get was from the other guy.
Now, Gilles, was that still going on by the time you played? Was there, the camaraderie between goalies? Was that still going on at the time?
Emil put Eddie and I in the same room on the road, you know, and we talk all the time. We got along so good. And if I could see a player that I knew had this kind of shot, I would tell him, watch, left side or right side, and look for it.
Right. And, Ricky, you wanted to
sure,
ask another
I mean,
question?
That's the advantage they had.
Go ahead, Ricky.
Go ahead.
Okay. I'm sorry, guys. Chili, I just wanted to ask you one quick question. I mean, growing up, I used to remember the battles with Eddie Jockman and Gary Dornhofer and Gary Howard. You should just drive poor Eddie Jockman crazy. He's hacking him. He's fighting him. What was the one player in the league at the time that maybe drove you a little nuts?
Gary Dornhofer. He was in the crease all the time. And I remember one day I went in front of him and pushed his back right into the net. He laughed at me in a sense because he was about a foot taller than I was. You know, he could have killed me. He just looked at me and said, what are you doing? I said, get out of my way, I said. But he was all right with me. He never hurt me.
Right, yeah. And, Gilles, did you ever use the stick? I mean, either one of you. First, I'll go with Gilles. Did you guys ever use that stick as a weapon to clear those big boys out in front of the crease?
No, I never did. Like Billy Smith?
Yeah.
I never did that. I wasn't big enough to fight those big guys, you know.
I got to confess to my sins I have. And
you like the lumber?
Yes, because, you know, I was small, and they'd come in the crease, and they would try to, you know, screen you and all that. And I'd take the stick, and again, right up between the legs, like, you know. And they'd say, you little bastard, you'll cut your head off. I said, well, you better make it good.
So now we're
playing in Springfield, like, you know, and Eddie Shore, and Jill knows who he was, like, you know. And he had a guy by the name of Buddy Bailey, who later went on to play with the Boston Bruins. So he comes in, he fires right in my head, like, you know. Of course, we didn't have masks in, like, you know, so I caught it. As he went by me, he took a two-hander, flashed me, like, you know. So he went around the net, and he came around the other side of the net. I got my goal stick, I hit him right over the head. Down he goes. And there's about a minute to go in the period, like, you know. Well, both benches clear, and sure, you know, he wasn't stupid, because he only had one goalkeeper then. He sent the police out, like, you know. So this guy comes up, this sergeant, and he goes to grab me by the arm, and I gave him a shove, and he went right on his behind, like, you know. So we take off, we leave the ice, and we go in the dressing room. And I'm sitting in that old Springfield arena, Jill, the old place, you know, at the fairgrounds. I thought it was a truck pulled up. I said, geez, that's a funny noise. And all of a sudden, the door busts open, and the guy I knocked on his behind, the sergeant, came in there with four policemen. He looks around the room, and he points to me. He says, that's him. Pick him up, put him in that wagon, he's going to jail. And we had a guy, and Jill knows the name, Freddie Glover. And Freddie Glover was a terrific player, like, you know, American League player. He takes a stick and he points the stick at the sergeant's throat. He said, if you take him, you're going to have to take all of us. God, these guys all got guns, like, you know. Well, just then our coach, Bun Cook, wanders in the room. He said, Captain, is there a problem here? Well, the guy wasn't the captain. He was a sergeant, like, you know. So Bun said, come on outside. I want to talk to you. So out they go. The sergeant and the policeman, they all go outside in the hall, like, you know. Well, that guy was going to have a last say, for sure. Back he comes again. This time with his, our coach is not coming back, but he comes back with his four assistants there, like, you know. He comes right up to me. He puts his finger right in my nose. He says, now listen to me. Any more trouble out of you, you're going to go to the Hoosgog. You know what you're going to do? You're going to go to jail. I said, don't worry. There'll be no trouble. They only had one goalkeeper. Sure, put him up to it, you see. He wanted them to take me away. Then who the hell is going to play goal?
Right. Yeah. Eddie Shaw's fault.
Yeah, really. Oh, no. He knew what he was doing.
Emil and Jill's, just so you guys know, while we do the show here, we have our listeners are in a chat room, and they chat amongst each other while they're listening to you guys. And they've been throwing out a couple of questions, so let me get to a couple of these. One of the guys wanted us to ask, Gilles, did you ever have to face the Rangers after you were with the Blackhawks?
I don't think, no, yes, I did. As a matter of fact, I played one game in the Garden, and we tied the game 3-3. Yes.
And, Gilles, don't you have a story about you versus Eddie Jachman when he was in Detroit and you were in Chicago?
Oh, my God, yeah. The play was going on. No, there was a face-off, I guess. And he looked at me, shake his shoulders. I did the same thing. Like, you know, we were talking about 100 feet away or something.
You gave him a wave. He gave you a wave.
Oh, you give me a wave. I give him a wave, you know. We've been together for 5 years, you know.
Yeah, roommates and all. I mean, any other questions, Jim, in the chat room?
Yeah, there was one other question that somebody mentioned a while ago. We just didn't, we haven't gotten to it yet. What was it like when Derek Sanderson came to the Rangers? Somebody wanted to know what that was like.
Who you asking?
Emil will tell you.
Either one of you.
I'll tell you what I thought about Derek Sanderson. I mean, he was one of the best penalty killers and definitely one of the best face-off people we had in the National Hockey League. Now, he had got sidetracked, you know. He went on to Philadelphia when the World Hockey came along and got a lot of money, like, you know, and of course, he blew that, like, you know, but went back to Boston, and I made a deal and brought him to New York because, you know, you like to have depth, and that was real. We had real good depth at center, like, you know, with Rattel and Jankowski and Tkachuk, and Sanderson was like our fourth center. And those are four pretty good centers to have, like, you know. And he didn't give me any problems at all. The problems started when the World Hockey is full force now. I couldn't do everything. I finally brought in Ron Stewart. And turned out that, you know, that was a bad marriage with Derek Sanderson and Ron Stewart. And I had to trade Derek Sanderson to St. Louis for a first-round draft pick. But I had no problems with him at all. He was, to me, one of the best face-off people I've ever seen in the National League.
Right, and you had the infamous... Well, okay, go ahead, Jill.
No, he's right.
I was going to say that you had the infamous incident between what it's turned out that it wasn't really an incident, at least we've read that it wasn't, when Eddie Jachman talked to Sanderson during a face-off and said there's a bounty after you. What really went down with that, Emil, and maybe Gilles, you could tell us a little bit about that. But Emil first.
I don't know. I don't remember that one. Emil must remember.
Yeah,
okay.
I was to the right of the net, and the face-off was like we lost the first two games in Boston, and we're back in New York, and I mean it was a game we had to win, like, you know. And the face-off was to the right of our net, and evidently, I mean, there was no bounty in Derek Sanderson. The game took about 4 hours to play because I think we had about 30 fights. But Eddie evidently skated out there and told him that there's a bounty in your head, we're going to get you tonight. Well, he made it up, I guess, because there was no such thing.
Right, yeah.
Threw him off his game. We tried to throw him off his game. But we won the game anyway. It was a long night.
All right, I think we had two more questions that came in from the chat room that we'll throw out to you guys. The first one is, what is your take on the Winter Classics that the NHL is playing on New Year's Day?
Go ahead, Jill.
The Winter Classic is great for everybody. You know, you pick your own country, and you know, you use the best players. It's good for hockey. It's going to help hockey a lot.
Not so much the Winter Olympics. I think he's talking about the outdoor game that they play.
The outdoor game.
Yeah, the outdoor game, Jill.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. When I watched the Buffalo game and it was snowing there, it reminded me of when I was about 10, 12 years old. Getting outside rink back home in Three Rivers. That was beautiful.
Yeah, I love it.
That's where we all started, and that's how hockey began. Like, you know, I think it's a great thing. It's a good promotion for hockey. It gets a great rating, and it really helps sell the game, like, you know, in this country. And there are a lot of cities in this country where you have to sell hockey. I'm talking about the southern cities. I'm talking about Atlanta, like, you know, and Nashville and Florida and Phoenix. I mean, you know, you have to sell the game there, and this is one of the ways to sell the game.
Yeah, okay. I wish they would have one in New York. Oh, go ahead.
Well, hopefully next year, I guess.
Yeah, I was really disappointed.
About.
Like, you know, the game is going to be in Boston this year. And there's the logical team to be playing the Boston Bruins is the New York Rangers at Fenway Park. I couldn't believe
that
they picked Philadelphia to play against the Boston Bruins. Should have been the New York Rangers. I mean, if I was running the New York Rangers of the league and there's a game in Yankee Stadium, you know who I want to come in there? The Boston Bruins.
That's right. Philadelphia is an expansion team, as far as I'm concerned. I want the original six.
There's no way.
I like the idea. You know, they talked about playing a doubleheader on New Year's Day of Winter Classics, and I like the idea of doing that, but making sure that one of those games is an original six matchup, you know, Montreal and the Rangers, and then play another a second game, you know, whoever, Buffalo and, you know, Atlanta.
Yeah, let's Philadelphia
like
play
that.
Pittsburgh with.
Yeah,
Boston should play the New York Rangers, like, you know.
Yeah,
back to the original 16s.
Exactly. They could teach a little more about the history of the game that way.
Yep.
Okay, and then the one final thing that came out of the chat room, and we did want to talk to you guys about it, his recent passing was Bill Chadwick.
Oh, God.
We had John Halligan on not too long ago, Emil, and he had some great Bill Chadwick stories for us, and maybe you can tell us a little bit about your relationship with Bill.
Well, I was the guy that picked him, like, you know. I mean, when I first went to New York, they wouldn't put our games on TV live. They'd put them on, like, that night. We played an afternoon game, they'd put them on night, you know. And then they'd only put on the last two periods. So, you know, you really had to sell the TV stations to put us on, like, and what have you. So Bill Chadwick, I mean, he had retired. And I knew him. He was one of the best referees I'd ever seen, like, you know. And so being a New Yorker, I mean, he knew what it was all about there. So I approached him on doing the color for us at the Ranger games. And he did. And I knew, I mean, you know, he would tell it like it was. And that's what he did. And sometimes, like, you know, I'm sure the players didn't like it so much because their wives would be watching the games and they'd tell their husbands what Bill had said about them, like, you know, and then one or two players would come up and say, well, he said this, he said that. I said, you play the game and forget about what's going on in the telecast. That's not who you're making your living. You're making your living play hockey. So forget what he said. Like, you know, but that's the way he was. I mean, he knew the game, and he told it as he seen it, and that's what you wanted. And he was on there for many years with us, with the Rangers, like, you know. And I'll tell you, if there ever was a Ranger fan, it was him, like, you know. But, hey, I'd never, ever try to stop him from expressing how he felt and what he seen, because that was his job.
Oh, yeah.
He may have said, which I didn't even know, that, hey, Francis blew that, he put the wrong guys up. He may have said that, but that was his job. It wasn't me to question him. I hired him to tell it the way it was, and he did.
And I noticed, Gilles, you always said that he was good to the players, right?
Well, he was very good to the players, and he was good for. He used to travel with us in the airplane wherever we went, and I always sat beside him. And he was what a great guy he was, you know. And he loved hockey. That's what he talked about, really. And we got along well with him. He loved everybody. Everybody loved him.
You know, one of the things I remember about him, when every time they would go to Toronto, him and King Clancy would get together, and they'd be laughing about things. We wouldn't even know what they're laughing about. We were laughing at home just because they were laughing, you know?
They were both great referees.
So that's how they got their friendship. I was not aware that King Clancy was a referee before he was the general manager of the Leafs.
He was a great referee. He was a great player to begin with. That's how Toronto built their franchise. Connie Smith went to a racetrack and won $25,000, and he started the Toronto New Panthers, and he called them the Toronto Maple Leafs, and he won $25,000. He went to Ottawa and bought him with the money he won at the racetrack, and he bought King Clancy from Ottawa. And he was a guy that they started and built the franchise on. and he was a great player with the Toronto Maple Leafs. And then following his playing career, he became a referee. And he was a real good referee for many, many years, and for some reason, he decided he wanted to be a coach. And the Montreal Canadiens put a farm club in Cincinnati, and the Rangers put in a half a team, and the Montreal put in a half a team. And I was one of the first guys to play with him. The Rangers, 10 of us, had to go there and play for him. And I really liked him. He was a great guy. Like, he was the guy that challenged me, like, you know, on the first baseman's mitt I used, because he was refereeing at the time, and he was the premium referee in the National League. You can't use that. Remember I told you that?
And, right, yeah, yeah.
Because Jack Adams, the coach of Detroit, complained that my glove was too big, like, you know. Well, later on, I played for King, and he was a great guy. Great guy, you know, a typical Irishman, like, you know, exuberant guy, like, you know. And,
he was a terrific guy to play for. I get the feeling him and Bill, they tossed back some alcoholic beverages as soon as they left.
That's very possible.
I'm sure we're playing in Chicago. We come back to play there, and, you know, Johnny Mariucci, who's veteran of the team, he was 36, and we're playing as an incident in the beginning of the second period, and Mariucci goes over to King Clancy, you know, to complain, and I see King pointing at him, like, you know, Mariucci keeps talking. She said, minor penalty, misconduct penalty, and he threw him out of the game. I said, what the hell is going on here, like, you know? Well, what happened is that at the first period when he complained about something, and Clancy says, I don't see the C, because there were new jerseys, and they hadn't put the captain on there, the C or the assistant captain. So what Mariucci did, he put a big C on his underwear. So the second period, he went to complain again, and Clancy says, you don't have a C. So Mariucci pulled up his sweater. He had a big C in his underwear, and he threw him out of the game. They were characters, I'll tell you. They're good guys.
That sounds like something Sean Avery would do.
Yeah, yeah, really. You're right.
Now, I know that both of you still follow the game, which before the show we started – we were talking to Amy before we came on the air. He's watching the Islander Flyer game. And I was like, wow, you know, Amy is still keeping up with the game and still with the passion. And I know Gilles is, you know, he still follows the game. Much to our Ranger chagrin, Ranger fan chagrin, one of his favorite goalies, present-day goalies, is Martin Brodeur. And why don't you tell the fans why you like Martin Brodeur so much, Gilles?
Well, you know, as a goaltender, every play is different. You know what I mean? And most of the kids in our days get flopped. They just go on their knees on almost every shot. And Martin Brodeur doesn't do that. He stands up. He goes on his knees. He stands up. He goes sideways. He never does the same thing twice. And, you know, like, he's got the best record ever. And I like the way he plays. I love the way he plays.
Okay. Emil, is there any guys that you see today that you really like in today's hockey that you kind of say, this guy could play in your era?
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, as Jill mentioned, hit the nail right on the head. Martin Brodeur could play at any time. Like, you know, and I would have to say that, to me, the best goalkeeper I've seen in the National Hockey League is Terry Savchuk. And when Terry Savchuk broke in, he was about 6'1", weighed about 220. And when he ended up his career with the Rangers, he was about 175 and had shrunk to about 5'11". But what he was, like, you know, he's a guy that was really a coach goalkeeper because he was big, like, you know, he could bend over halfway down in front of the net and he'd cover the whole net. If I'd bend down like that, I would only be covering half of the net, like, you know. But Terry Savchuk had a great glove hand. And that came from the reason that he was a good baseball player. He played in Winnipeg in the Mandak League. He was a first baseman. And he had good hands, and he could hit. He was a good baseball player along with being a good goalkeeper. But he's a guy that reminds me of all the goalkeepers I've ever seen. The guy who reminds me most of him is Martin Brodeur.
All right, so you guys are on the same page.
And the funny thing is, like, you know, I thought Martin Brodeur would have seen him play, but then when you look back, Martin Brodeur wasn't born until 2 years after Terry died, so he couldn't have seen him play. Like, you know?
That's true.
Another guy coming up right now is Lundqvist. Lundqvist is a great goaltender.
Oh, yeah.
I know. I like his style. He's
hard
to get beat on the ice. He's so quick on the ice. It's unbelievable.
Both of you were goaltenders. Henrik's having a little bit of a slump now. When a goaltender slumps, has it just got to work itself out, or is there something that you can do to kind of rectify that?
With me, it was mechanically, and I think I told you that. The best friend you have is a goalkeeper in the other team. And I was getting beat on the glove side, and I couldn't understand it because that was my strength, And I passed Frankie Brimsek at center ice, and I said, "Can I see you after the game?" He said, "Meet me in the bar downstairs." And I went down there, and he was sitting in the back booth, and he called me over. He said, "What's your problem?" I said, "I'm getting beat on my glove side, which I shouldn't get beat on." Well, he said, "Do you play baseball?" I said, "Yeah." He said, "What position do you play?" I said, "Shortstop." He said, "You're playing goal like you play baseball." I said, "What do you mean by that?" He says, "As a shortstop, you charge the ball, right?" And I said, "Yeah." He says, "That's what you're doing. You're charging the puck. You're coming out too fast." So I said, "What do you recommend?" He said, "Slow yourself down. Don't come out so quick. And that way, you won't get yourself out of position. By coming out too quick, now you got to back up. Instead of you having the glove in front of you when you come out, your glove's in behind you, and it's that split second that's what's beating you." And I said, "Anything else?" He said, "Yeah." He said, "I'm a little bigger than you, but not much. What light goal stick do you use?" I said, 11. Well, he said, "I'm a little bigger than you, but not much." He said, "Try using a light 13, and that'll lift you up, and you'll cover more of the net." I did that, no problem. He knew right away what it was.
But how about you, Gilles?
Mechanics very important. Sometimes, you lose the net, you don't know where you are in the net. You got to figure out a way to know where you are in the net. There's some spots on the ice that can help
angles.
But sometimes you don't think about that, You don't. Concentration is very, very important for a goaltender. If you concentrate, you're going to do all right. Sometimes if you play too many games, like not long quiz plays, sometimes you get a little tired, and I don't think the concentration is there as much. You know what I mean?
Right.
Because he plays 70 games a year. That's a lot of games nowadays.
See, that's where you guys had the advantage. You had two great goaltenders you can go with at any time. And, especially if one of you goes down by injury, you got the other guy to step right in. The Rangers right now, if Lundqvist gets hurt, they're done. Done. They're in big trouble.
They're in trouble. That's why sometimes, that many games, it hurts you a little bit.
Right, exactly. Now, Emil, I wanted to ask you, is there some guy you perhaps drafted or you got or acquired while you were with the Rangers that you thought he was going to be really good, but he just didn't pan out, or maybe a player who was a young guy who had a lot of potential but just didn't get there?
Yeah, Gene Carr. Gene Carr was
really
one of the best skaters that you ever want to see, but Gene Carr could get lost in the phone booth. The best series he had with us, we played Montreal, and they had Ivan Cornway, and Carr is the only guy on our team that could skate with him. So I told him, I said, "Gene, I don't even want you to worry about the puck. I'm going to put you on the ice against him. Every time he's on the ice, you're going to go with him. All you do, you look at him. When he goes, you go. If he goes to the toilet, you go to the toilet." And we had a six-game series. We beat out Montreal. And Cornwallier got one goal, and that was on the power play when Gene Carr wasn't on the ice. And that was his shining star with us, is that one series against Montreal, But I'll tell you, it came to the point that I knew how to get rid of him. We're playing in Vancouver. We had a flight to Seattle. So we flew to Seattle, and I said, "Okay, follow me," because I played in Seattle. I knew the airport everywhere we were going. And this is our first trip there. So they're following me. We go here. We get on a little train. We're on the train. We're going over to another terminal to get Air Canada to go to Vancouver. And Gene Carr comes up, stands beside me. He said, "Mr. Francis, can I ask you a question?" I said, "Go ahead, shoot." He said, "I'm looking at the itinerary. It didn't say that we're going to go to Vancouver by train." I said, enough's enough. We're going to train from one terminal to another. We weren't going to Vancouver by train. So that's the way he was, Then we got back to New York, and he forgot where he parked his car, and he had to hire a cab, and it cost him $45 to find his car. But, those things happen.
Why didn't you send him to the police like you did Freddie Shero?
I should have. I should have.
Oh, that's just funny. Now, you know, Emil, we got to talk about it because, I mean, this is, you know, your departure from the Rangers, it's sad, and it was a tumultuous time, a tough time, and the big trade. Now, from what I've heard is you got pressure from the Garden to make the trade, to make a change.
No.
What is the real story?
No, I didn't get pressure from anybody. I mean, we had a team that I thought was capable of winning, and we didn't, like, you know, and it was time to make a change. No, nobody ever told me what to do at Madison Square Garden as far as the team or trades or what have you. Nobody. Whatever I did on my own because that was my job. Nobody. The only thing that anybody ever told me to do was the last time I was there, the last year I was there. And, you know, the World Hockey were going full steam. And I was doing everything, and I knew that the time come I had to bring in somebody. Like, and when I brought in Ron Stewart, and we got off to a wobbly start, and we're in December, and we're still only 5 points out of a playoff spot at that time. And Alan N. Cohen, who was the chairman, chief executive of Madison Square Garden, called me Christmas Eve. He said, I want you to fire that coach that you brought in here, and you go back and coach yourself. I told him, I said, I ran this club now for 12 years. I haven't needed any help. I don't need any help now. And I hung up. And I had to go to Montreal. I was chairman of the general managers committee. We were meeting in Montreal on Sunday. And Sunday night, about 10:30 at night, I got a call from Bill James, who's president of the Rangers. And he said, I just talked to Alan Cohen, and he said that he had a conversation with you last night. I said, yeah. He said, where are you going from here? I said, our team is playing in St. Louis Tuesday, and I'm going to St. Louis. He said, you better come back, because Mr. Cohen would like to meet with you. I said, fine.
Uh-uh.
And I had my chief scout with me that day. I hung up the phone. I said, well, Steve, this is it. I'm all finished with the New York Rangers. What are you talking about? I said, here's what happened. So I went back to New York, and I got back Monday noon, and I started packing my stuff. 3 o'clock, I was supposed to meet with Cohen. I went up to room 200, where Jill knows where it's at. I pressed the buzzer, and up comes Bill Jennings. I walked in, I looked around the room, I said, where's Mr. Cohen? He said, he's not here. He said he had an emergency meeting as usual, like, you know. He said, I have to talk to you. So we sat down, he said, well, he said, you have two choices. You could resign, or he said, you can get fired. I said, you and I have worked together all these years, and you're telling me I can resign? I said, I've never quit anything in my life. If you want to fire me, I said, go ahead and fire me. He said, you're fired. He said, it'll take about 30 minutes to get a press release together. And he said, we want your permission to put up the press release. I said, I'll tell you what you do. You take that press release and put it up you know where, so the sun doesn't shine. And I got up and I walked out of there, and that was it.
And that was it.
Wow.
Now,
yep.
But what a,
that was it.
But what about the trade, the infamous trade, Rattel going and for Esposito, what was the reason for that? Who was behind that?
I was behind it because we hadn't won. I mean, we'd had our opportunities to win. In regards to the fact that we were always had to somehow or other come up with bad injuries at the wrong time, but we still didn't win. And that team was built to win, and we didn't win. So it was time to make a change. Simple as that.
All right, there you got it, right from the cat's mouth.
Oh, yeah. Nobody ever told me what to do, believe me. I did what I had to do, and that was it.
And, you know, you went on and you coached GM St. Louis. You had some teams there, and Hartford. You had a great career.
I built three teams. I built the Rangers, I built St. Louis, and I built Hartford. And they weren't easy jobs, believe me, because when I heard those three teams, they were lousy.
Yeah, that's true.
And it took a lot of work. It took a lot of work.
All right. Now, Emil, I want to ask you one question because you have a knowledge that spans decades. I want to know right now, give me your top five toughest SOBs that ever laced the skates up you played against, coached against, or GM'd against. Give me your top five toughest SOBs.
Well, the first guy will be Gordie Howe. He never went looking for trouble, but if there's any trouble around, like, you know, he would look after real good. Terry O'Reilly with the Boston Bruins, great guy, very aggressive guy, tough guy. Orlin Kurtenbeck with the New York Rangers. Ron Harris with the New York Rangers, I'd take, like, you know.
Uh-huh.
Anytime I'd take him. And a guy that played years ago with the Chicago Blackhawks, a guy by the name of Adam Brown. He was
a real
toughie, like, you know. Yeah, Adam Brown. And I'd even give you a sixth guy from the Chicago Blackhawks, who's an All-American footballer at the University of Minnesota, Johnny Mariucci. A lot of people don't even know the name, but I'll tell you. When I broke in with Chicago, we had a lot of little guys, you know, the two Bentleys and Mosianko. We had a small team. And if anybody ever touched any one of those guys, Mariucci would take him on. And there's another guy who, the best fight I ever seen in the National League was between Johnny Mariucci and Black Jack Stewart with the Detroit Red Wings. I'll never forget. I mean, they fought in the middle of Chicago Stadium, you know, 22,000 people there, and the referees, they all ran. Nobody wanted to come near that fight. And neither one of them quit. They just got tired, like, you know. Hey, Joe.
Well, how about... Oh, go ahead. Ask Jill.
I wanted to ask Jill if you ever heard of those guys, Mariucci and Black Jack Stewart. And...
No, I didn't. Okay, that was before me.
Now, Emil, how about Leaping Louie Fontanato? What about Reg Fleming? You coach Reg. Was he a tough guy?
Yeah, I had them both. Yeah, he was. He was, and Louie was, but not as tough as the guys I told you.
Now, Emil, you drafted I got to say, I looked at one of these drafts. Steve Durbano. This guy was what a character. This guy turned out to be.
Yeah,
what was the deal?
He got on the funny stuff. The only guy I ever had was ever associated with, like, you know. And he got on that funny crap. And he had a short career.
Yeah, and unfortunately, he's no longer with us because of that funny stuff.
No. That's right.
He went down the wrong path. Unfortunately, that happens. Gilles, I wanted to ask a question just for Gilles. We got about 10 minutes left. I tell you, guys, with the 2 hours here, we're talking just Ranger hockey. I love it. You know, Gilles, I wanted to ask you, you know, like I asked Emil about players that never really developed into fully. Were there any goaltenders that you saw that they really maybe had the skills but didn't really have the mental capacity to play the game, that they could have been better? Because we all know the mental part of goaltending is really important. And maybe you could explain to the fans about the mental part of the game.
Well, that's what I said before when I said about concentration. You know what I mean? It's hard to do to concentrate for 60 minutes in every game. But if you do it every game, you're going to be a good goaltender. That's the most important thing for a goaltender, concentration. You have to concentrate. And you know, when I played in 70 with Emil, every goaltender was good. You know, we had great goaltenders. Tony Esposito, Eddie Jackman, Bernie Perron, Ken Dryden. I can name you 20 of them.
Right.
They all were great goaltenders, really. We had a good group of goaltenders then.
I mean, you know, even a little bit before that, Johnny Bauer. I mean, the guys.
Yeah, that's before me.
Right.
Yeah, that was before me. But Roger Crozier, guys like that. You know, they were great goaltenders. Jerry Cheevers, man. Oh, my gosh, there were so many.
It must have been, you know, who was your biggest rival, Gilles? Who did you get up to play against? Who was the team that you really wanted to beat them? Or was it every team, basically, you faced?
No. Well, you play against Montreal, Boston. You know what I mean? They're big teams. They're the two teams that you have to be ready because they were good, both of them, you know, in the 70s. You know, Montreal, you go to Montreal, they would never lose any games. Same thing in Boston. Boston, remember one game, I had 54 shots against me. You know, they were ready to play against us.
Now, Amy, was there a coach that you wanted to win against more than maybe some other coach? Some other coach kind of gave you the business if when you lost. Was there any kind of coach you had a rivalry with?
Well, I would say that the two teams, like, you know, to me, the teams that you wanted to deep to most was Montreal Canadiens and Boston Bruins. Because, you know, I broke in, there were six teams. And, you know, the Boston and New York, Boston were the same as us. When I took over the Rangers, they used to say that the Rangers and Boston played for the Patrick Trophy because one team finished five and the other team finished six or 6-5, like, you know. The other four teams had a cakewalk into the playoffs. Four teams out of six, and the Rangers and the when I took over the Rangers, they missed the playoffs 9 out of 10 years.
Wow.
So Boston were no better at that time either. Boston turned their franchise around when Bobby Orr came along. And they were a different franchise and a different team like that. Like, there's no
that would
way,
have turned anybody's franchise around, getting Bobby Orr.
That's right. But, you know, Boston beat us in 71, and they won the Stanley Cup. They beat us, but we beat them the next year. I mean, we didn't have Raquel when we played them, but the next year they didn't have Esposito because, like I told you, he got knocked out in the second game. So, the teams were so evenly balanced that Orr was the difference, no doubt, the first time we played him. The second time we played him, Orr wasn't the difference because we knocked Esposito the hell out of there. Like, we had lost Raquel the first time we played him, like, you know. But when we played Boston, I mean, they're Montreal, I mean, that was teams that, they were along with you. The three of us were, I mean, we went 3 years in a row. We had over 110 points and didn't end up in first. We ended up in second. We ended up, with 110 points. That's how good those teams were, too, like, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
but
it
was
just, you know.
We beat up Montreal twice, right in Montreal, and knocked them the hell out with Bowman when he first came there. He's like he didn't lose his job. He would have been around to win 9 Stanley Cups, I'll tell you.
You could have ended his career right there. He would have never won the Cups.
You're
right.
You're not kidding. And he inherited good teams along the way, believe me.
I have a question about Rod Gilbert now. Rod was never the captain of the Rangers. Was he just not his personality, or it was Jean who was just, you know, the guy that really represented the team on the ice, or Brad?
No, I think that I don't know why he wasn't. I mean, I can't tell you that, but I mean, I was the guy that selected Brad Park to be the captain of the team. You know, when he came, and he was the captain until he was traded, like enough. And then I was gone, and then I guess, who the hell was it? Ferguson made Esposito the captain of the team, and I'm sure that wasn't the best move that you could make.
No.
Because Rod by
Phil didn't,
seniority, like, you know.
Right. And Phil really didn't want
to be.
I mean, Phil hated New York. He didn't, at the first, he didn't want to play. You know, he was like, he hated everything about it, but then he grew to love it. And, you know, the whole thing. And, you know, it just was an interesting time, and it was a team. But really, Emil, you got the Rangers back on track, like you said. I mean, you know, again, after you left, they took a little dip again, but then they got better. Yeah. And then, you know, a couple bumps in the road, and now we're in another big bump. But I guess that's what the Ranger, being a Ranger fan, supporter is all about. There's a lot of bumps in the road.
Yeah, they got better because of the players I left them, not because of what he had done. I mean, first of all, I traded for John Davidson. And when they went to the finals with Montreal Canadiens, Davidson was a goalkeeper, like, you know. And the other guy, I had traded Gene Carr to L.A. for first round draft choice. And Ron Duguay came in there and was the star with the Rangers, like, you know. So it wasn't that how he built it is what he inherited, really.
And Emil, you drafted Greschner and Maloney, is that correct?
You're not kidding, both in the same year. And those guys were that was a funny story, like, yeah. In those days you could draft a 17-year-old player, but you had to take him with your first choice. And Maloney was 17 years old. And Greschner was 18. And he was playing for the New Westminster Bruins, and Maloney was playing for the Kitchener Rangers. So I'm thinking, how the hell am I going to get around this? Because I want them both, like, you know. So about a month before the draft, Vancouver Blazers were in the World Hockey, and Joe Crozier, who'd been with Buffalo in the National League, was out there going to take over and run the team. So I had a couple stalwarts who started the rumor that Gretzner signed with the Vancouver Blazers. And it made sense because he played New Westminster, you know, which is a suburb of Vancouver. Because we're going to take our chance, take Maloney as a 17-year-old. We had to take him in the first round draft. Don't you think we take Maloney in the first round, 17 years old? Second round, guess who's waiting there for us? Ron Gresham. We got them both in the same draft.
Wow.
So a little lie paid dividends.
Two captains drafted in back-to-back rounds. I mean, I don't
know.
Right. I wonder if that's ever been done before or since.
Yeah. And a little lie helped, if you know what I mean.
Now you succeed in business, just a little white lie. I mean, that's all you need.
Yeah, a little white lie. You got that
now,
right.
Amy,
and they were both.
Amy, you coached our fearless leader, Glenn Sather. Could you tell us, Glenn Sather, what type of player was he and what kind of personality he was as a player?
He was a team player. I mean, you know, he didn't get regular shifts, like, you know. He was on the fourth line. He was a good penalty killer. And if you wanted to, you know, get your team, roast them up, like you put him out there, like he was a troublemaker, like, you know. He'd take on anybody, whoever it was. I'll never forget him. When we opened the Garden, the first year we went in the Garden, they had the NBA playoffs. And I guess, like, the Knicks were playing Philadelphia, and somebody came in through the roof and down at the dress room, and they robbed Philadelphia of all their money. So now the NBA passed the rule that every team had to have a safe in the dress room, like in the trainer's room. So the Rangers had to get a safe like everybody else. Here we are, we're playing the opening game. And we had our warm-up. We come back in, like, you know, and I used to, before going into the dress room, I would sit over in the Knick dress room all by myself. So I come out there, and here's Glenn Sather. He's on his hands and knees, and he's got that safe, you know, working it. And in comes Frank Pace, our trainer with the Rangers. Just as he walked in the room, guess what? Glenn said they opened that safe. Frank Pace yells at him. He says, "What the hell are you doing? You think that's a toy?" He opened the safe. Well, guess what? The next day they took that safe out. Never seen it again. He opened up the safe in that training room. Like, you know.
He's
now
a
we're
brown.
Playing,
won that Sather.
Oh, yeah. So now we're playing in Philadelphia, and they had this big defenseman. God, I forget his name. He weighed about 240 pounds, and the face-off is about 6 feet in front of our bench, like, you know. And he'd ran at a couple of players, like, you know, and he was a big, soft-looking guy. I yelled at him, I said, "Hey, you donkey, I said, why don't you play hockey and get away from all that crap out there?" So he come running towards the bench, like, you know, and he got about 2 feet in front, and Glenn Sather stood up and bopped him, knocked him cold. That's the kind of guy he was. Like, he was a team man. Now, if that guy had come near me, I don't know what the hell I would have done, but he never got close to me because Sather hit him with one punch and knocked him cold. Right in front
now,
of our bench, like, you know.
Emil, did you really call him a donkey or something else?
I was going to ask the same question.
No, it's probably something else.
I had a feeling just after
I said,
talking to you tonight,
I said, you're
something a little more colorful.
Yeah, I yelled at him, I said, you're so goddamn out of shape you can't even spit over your chin.
That's great.
I was a bench
you.
Jockey at times, you know.
Now, Gilles, you're on the bench and you're sitting there. Did Emil really chat it up like that? I mean, you know, when you weren't dressed, you were, would he chat it up?
He was calling everybody names, I'll tell you. He had some big names. The one I remember the most was, "You a hot dog, you." You know, he used to say that to every game. He just call the referee, you know, what he thought. Oh, yeah, he was chatting and he was screaming. Oh, yes, he was all the time.
Oh,
I wish
I
had all the money back that I had to pay.
In fines, right?
Anyway, it was a lot of fun. Pardon?
It was.
You guys have been great, and we want to thank you. I can't believe it. 2 hours has already passed, and we had such a great time. I tell you, I haven't laughed like this about hockey and going down the old days and getting the information the way it was and how it was. I got to say, I mean, this people that were in the chat room I was telling you about are saying this is our best show by far, and I would love to have you guys on again sometime down the road. But this was just great. Emil, you were fantastic. And Jill, thank you so much.
Well, hey.
It was a pleasure. It was
you
a
had
pleasure.
A guy on there that I've – you had a real team man on there in Jill Villemere, so he knows what I think of him. I mean, he and Eddie Jochman, I mean, they were the best combination you could ever have as far as goalkeepers. And we had great seasons with those two guys in goal.
And the people want to just say, I'm reading right here, it says, tell them we love them. So all the Ranger fans out there still love you guys. You're number one in our books.
Yes, Emil, it was a real pleasure. Gilles, thank you so much for joining us tonight. And,
no problem. It's a pleasure.
And helping us surprise Emil a little bit. And
surprised me.
No problem.
Sure, but I know Gilles. Gilles is always available. He's everywhere, that guy. He's a PR guy.
Hey,
Emil,
I can't wait.
Garden.
Hey, Emil, I can't wait to see you in the garden. I haven't seen you this year yet.
I know. I'll get there, Gilles. We'll see you soon.
Okay. Very good.
See you, my
all
friend.
Right, take,
okay.
All right. Well,
take care, guys.
We'd love to talk to you guys again after the holidays. Enjoy. Have a healthy one, and we'll
okay,
talk
again.
To you soon.
Yeah. All right, Eddie. See you guys.
Take care.
Happy
take
holidays.
Care, Emil.
Okay, take care, Mel.
You too.
Take care, Mel. Take care.
See you,
happy
Jill.
Holidays.
Good luck.
Happy holidays. Bye. Take care. Thank you.
Bye.
Okay. That's it?
That's it.
Hold on, I think I disconnected. Yes, I disconnected Emil. Did you?
Yeah,
did you disconnect Jill's?
Yeah, we off the air.
We're in the podcast now.
Okay.
Wow. Wow.
That was funny, man.
I mean, I've never heard you laugh like that.
Oh man, come on. He's telling those stories.
I've heard you laugh, but not like that. I mean, you and I were just, he's just going on and on. You and I are just laughing our asses off. I mean, that's great. That's great. Everybody enjoyed that.
Malcolm, am I still on?
Ricky's still on. Ricky, you're still
on. Oh, man. Thank you so much, guys. That was a thrill.
Our pleasure. Our pleasure.
I tell you, it's like listening. You know how, like, when you get around, like, the older people in your family that you really respect and, you know, they've been through stuff? And this with hockey, this is the way it felt like me. I don't want to be too cheesy about it, but that's the way I felt, you know? Like, these are like,
was,
you know.
It was kind of like that cool uncle that you look forward to seeing just because, you know, he's the one that's got, like, a little money in his pocket that'll pass you when nobody's looking, you know, that type of thing. That's what they were like, the cool grand, you know, the cool uncle, the cool grandpa or something like that. I mean,
it
was just like.
Memories.
And it was like we were sitting around a bar, you know, just talking to him. I mean, that could not have gone any better than it did.
Yeah.
Getting Gilles on, that was a real good idea we had.
Yeah, because it was either between Gilles and Stemkowski, although apparently Stemkowski might have been funnier since he has all the stories. But Gilles doesn't speak a lot, you know, he short bursts. He doesn't really have, like, Emil could talk fucking 5 hours. I mean, let's face it. He was great.
There was one classic part, Mouth, when Emil asked Jilly something, and he went, no, do that. And it was like, he asked him about the stick. When somebody asked him about if he used the stick, and he sounded just like the goalie from Slapshot. He's like, no, do that, no, do that.
Yeah, so it was really good. I had a great time. I was just soaking it in, man. I was just like, let them run with the whole thing, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Definitely the highlight of my Blog Talk Radio career.
Without a doubt. Without a doubt. I can't wait to listen back to this tomorrow at work.
Yeah.
So.
Oh, go ahead.
No, I was, what were you going to say?
No, I think I'm just going to do the show from like 6:30 to like game time tomorrow with Mandar. And I don't even know if I should do one tomorrow. But, because I don't know. The game starts at 8:30. You know. Plus, after this, what am I going to do to top this?
Castrate
Nothing.
Is that really top it? Is that really top this, though?
I'd laugh like Mouth did tonight.
I'm telling you.
I had tears in my eyes at least three or four times. He had me laughing so hard. And when he told the story about flipping the guy from the Blackhawks the finger, oh my God, that was
that was funny.
Yeah, and it was a lot of fun. So, yeah, I'm probably not going to do a show tomorrow. I want to watch the game. I think it's I like the Blackhawks. I'll go on and watch it. But I don't know. I may change my mind. I don't really have anything to rant on. I got to be like after a game. Unless Zippe writes something more. Hey, thanks a lot, Rick, for bringing that up. I listened back to it, and I'm like, why did I go off on that Zippe rant? And you were like, hey, Mal, Zippe must have been listening to his show because he was talking about how Lundqvist doesn't get along with Tortorella.
Yeah, yeah.
Zippe heads!
You definitely went off on him for a good 20 minutes. That was great.
Yeah. Well, now Larry Brooks, did you see Blue Shirt Banter? Apparently, they have, well, Jim will tell you about it. They put he may have faked that story about Orpik, that we never offered him a contract.
Oh, really?
Brooks Orpik said that the Rangers offered him a contract. He told that to the Pittsburgh beat writer. He told him that the Rangers offered him a contract, and it was for more money than Pittsburgh offered, but he wanted to stay in Pittsburgh, so he took less money.
Right.
Larry Brooks wrote an article last week blasting Sather for not even offering Orpik a contract.
Right, and Orpik was waiting by the phone or something like that, he wrote.
Something like that. And this guy knows Craig, who runs Metro Hockey, some kid, he's a Ranger fan, and he goes to Stony Brook University or something like that. He went after Brooks, and he said, he said, how can you say that they never offered him a contract when Brooks Orpik is saying the Rangers offered me a contract? And Larry Brooks just kept coming back with, I stand by my story. I guarantee you they never offered him a contract. And then the guy goes to the Pittsburgh beat writer that wrote the story, and he said, I respect Larry Brooks, but, I was in the room when Brooks Orpik said it to me. That the Rangers offered him a contract. And this guy went back and forth with Larry Brooks quite a few times. And, of course, Brooks just, kind of said, go away, kid. You bother me. I know what I'm talking about. And, you're just a dumb Ranger fan. And, my whole take on it was, hasn't Glenn Sather done enough? Hasn't he made enough mistakes that you don't have to make shit up?
That's amazing, how much Brooks is a Ranger beat writer and how much he hates the Rangers.
Yeah. It's weird.
Yeah, he's a Devil guy. He was an original Devil, reporter. Him and that skank Sherry Ross, and they both just have every chance that they get to blast the Rangers. It's ridiculous.
It's funny.
She used to write out here in Jersey for a local paper, and she would just.
She wrote for the Ledger, didn't she?
The Bergen Records and the Ledger.
Bergen Records.
And she would just kill the Rangers. She would write a Devil article, and the last line of the paragraph would just be something obnoxious about them. The Rangers are their fans, every column,
That's funny. I was Sherry Ross. We're on a show and introduce her like that.
Next week on Blue Shirt Band of Radio, that's Gank, Sherry Ross. I was going, as I'm packing up, getting ready to move, I keep a lot of newspapers. I have all the newspapers from 94 and a few others, and I found a newspaper that I had saved. It's a New York Post from 1995, and it was a Larry Brooks article bashing the Islanders. I have no idea why I saved this thing for 15 years, but it was just funny to read it. They were a mess at the time, and he just went off on them. It was pretty funny. I don't even know why I saved it, but I still have it. I'll have to make a copy of it or something and send it to you, Eddie. You'll love it.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was a fantastic show, and Rick, great questions in the man. It's good. They really had a good time. I'm going to call Gilles tomorrow and ask him about, coming on the show. Maybe, even though Gilles, again, he's a guy that he likes one-word answers. It would be a little bit tough to do, an hour with him, but still, I think getting them two together was a good call, I think.
I wanted to have Emil back, shit, as many times as he wants. But so, I just thought it would be nice to do something really special, and it's, something that, nobody else is doing. You listen to that Ranger podcast, and they'll get Adam Graves and Mark Messier together, but,
What about doing something with the cat where you do, a show every couple months where you bring him on and he does a breakdown of the rivalries. Like he started to do with Boston tonight, maybe do Philly, the Islanders coming into the league, do a show like that. That'd be awesome.
Well, he doesn't like Dave Schultz. You can say that.
It was funny because
he used to call Schultz names in interviews when he was the Ranger general manager. He would say stuff like he said about tonight, about that on TV.
Right. It's funny, Ricky. Before we went on the air, we got him on the phone about 2 minutes ahead of time, and he says, "Hold on, I'm gonna put the phone down for a minute." He says, "I'm watching the hockey game." He says, "I just want to turn it down. I'm watching the Flyers and Islanders game." And he gets back on the phone, and Eddie and I were kind of, you know, we were giving him a hard time, saying that he's just sitting there yelling at both of those teams and that goddamn J.P. Parise, and he's laughing. And then he told us a funny story about who were the two teams he was – oh, Montreal and Calgary in the Stanley Cup Finals or something he was telling us.
Right, yeah. I was like, he's probably yelling
on the air.
Those damn expansion teams. Who cares about these teams? he was great. All right, guys, I got a mambo, but once again, a great show.
Good night.
All right,
Jed. See you tomorrow.
Good night.
Good night.
Thanks again, Rick.
Bye bye.
Good night.
Good night.